Okay, this is the special teleconference, 912 teleconference for Sunday, 10-20-2013. Our special guest, Chris Bolin, is with us. And, Craig, would you like to take the role?
Yeah, sure. It's, we just got somebody else.
Roger Lemkis.
Hey, Paul.
Hello, whoever that is.
This is Ken. We're just about to take the roll here, Paul, so hang loose there, and then we'll get started.
Okay.
Chris Bolin is with us already.
I'm going to mute my phone now.
Okay. Okay. But we know you're here, Paul, so just add him to the list, and then go ahead and read your phone, Paul.
So maybe when if there's anybody that isn't normally on the call, maybe they could also know if it happens or...
Okay, Craig, we're getting a lot of interference there. A lot of interference there when you were talking.
Okay.
I don't know
is that better?
Yes, it is. Yep.
Okay. I guess there's a certain part of my apartment I can't stand in, I guess, when I'm on the cell phone. Okay, so if people could, maybe people that aren't normally on the call could just let me know if there's any particular group affiliation that they would like listed in the role with their name, or any sort of how they would want to be described, because usually we do put a group affiliation if there is one. Maybe people could just, one at a time, somehow let me know who's there.
Robin Hood.
I hear Kurt Paul
directly,
and I know Adam Syed. Sorry?
Robin
Adam
Hood for 9/11 Truth for World Peace.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Robin Horton, 9/11 Truth for World Peace.
Okay, great. Thank you, Robin.
Jim Fetzer, Scholars for 9/11 Truth.
Okay, great. Hi, Jim.
Dwayne Dietz, San Diego, 9/11 Truth.
Barbara Honiger, Monterey, California, 9/11 Truth.
James Hufford, Iowa. 9/11 grassroots.
Ted Delaney.
Hello.
9/11 grassroots, Lafayette, Indiana.
Lorenzo, Boston area, 9/11 truth.
Lorenzo Fine, right?
FINE? That's FINE, sorry about that.
FINE?
Okay. I got Ned, I got Lorenzo.
You get Mike Booth?
Who else?
Christopher Bolin?
Yeah.
Well, of course, we have Christopher Bolin already.
Okay. I waited to... It's Barry's Wicker in Toronto. I waited to Alaska because my name starts with Zed.
Very quicker, right?
Yeah.
We're also getting more
interference. Can you repeat it again? Sorry, one more time?
It was Barry Zwicker, Barry Zwicker.
Oh, Barry. Okay, sorry. Sorry,
right.
Barry. Yeah, having a little bit of sound problem on my end. Sorry about that.
Yeah, some real bad interference there, I guess.
Yeah.
What is star six. If you want to mute your phone, it's star six, and then if you come back, it's just star six again. So star six will toggle your mute. Any for anybody that wants to cut out possible interference.
And Sheila Casey, I don't know if you got my name.
Yeah, Sheila Casey, sir.
Okay, great.
Did you get Mike Booth?
Who else?
Mike Booth.
Mike Booth.
Mike Booth, okay.
Mike Booth from Lafayette, Indiana.
Okay. Anybody else?
Dwayne, did you, are you still here? Dwayne Dietz? Dwayne?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, all right. I don't remember hearing him say he's here. Okay. All right, so Craig, please call the roll of the people that you have, and then anybody that's not on there, please let Craig know that you're here so that we can we can get started. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So I have Barbara Honegger, Adam Syed, Tim Freeland, Paul Zarenka, myself, Craig McKee, Robin Gordon, Jim Fester, Lane Beast, Jane Pufford, Ned Delaney, Lorenzo Fine, Christopher Boleyn, Barry Zwicker, Sheila Casey, and Mike Booth. Did I miss anyone?
All right. Thank you all for coming, and we're going to start off with Ned Delaney, who did the footwork on contacting Christopher to set up today's call, and he's going to give us an introduction for Chris, and then we'll proceed with a presentation from Chris, and then with questions in the order in which people registered for the conference. So go ahead, Ned.
Okay, some general information. Chris Boleyn is an American journalist. He's investigated the events of 9/11, as we all know. He helped Professor Stephen E. Jones in the spring and summer of 2006 when Jones found solid evidence of thermite in the dust of the Twin Towers. Discovery and discussion of thermite and the demolition of the World Trade Center led to serious trouble for both Jones and Boleyn. Then in August of 2006, Boleyn was attacked at his home in Hoffman Estates, Illinois, a heavily armed three-man team of undercover police that had been prowling around the house for several days in a row. The result, police assault on Boleyn was that he was falsely charged with assault and resisting arrest, both misdemeanor charges. He pled innocent and went through a four-day trial in which police openly lied and presented false evidence. Boleyn's evidence, on the other hand, was not allowed to be presented, and an expert witness was not allowed to testify. After the serious flawed trial, Boleyn was found guilty of both charges and faced sentencing from the same judge who had overseen the trial. Rather than submitting themselves to injustice, the Boleyn family left their home near Chicago and moved to Europe in June of 2007. He then wrote a set of books based on his 9/11 research entitled Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. I give you Chris Boleyn.
Thank you. Before Chris starts, Chris, I think we got one other person on the call. Who else just joined the call, please?
Gerhard Betty.
Gerhard
Betty.
Okay, and which group are you with, Gerhard?
It's Monadnock 9/11 Truth Alliance.
Thank you. Okay, Craig?
Okay.
Yeah, so I couldn't hear that at all. Could you...
I'm sorry, Greg Gerhardt, could you repeat your information, please?
Gerhardt Betting. I am with the Monadnock 9/11 Truth Alliance in southwestern New Hampshire.
Okay. Do you want to just tell your name for me just so I make sure I don't make
Oh, Betting, just like sheets and blankets. BEDDING.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Okay, we were just about to start to hear Gerhard and Christopher Boleyn going to now give us a presentation, and then we'll proceed with questions after that. Thank you. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. Okay. I want to say hello to everybody on this call. I recognize some of your names. I've met a few of you before. And thank you for being with on this call. The introduction was pretty concise and clear. And I have written two books, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and Solving 9/11, The Original Articles. They're two books. They're part of the same set, so they have the same title, and they have the same Library of Congress number. So the first book is basically my thesis, made very clear and concise in a very readable format. The second book, The Original Articles, has about 11 years of articles starting from 2001 up until 2012. And these articles contain the details and the information, the research that underpins the thesis in the book Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And some of you probably already know, my thesis is basically that 9/11 is a huge deception that was perpetrated by a false flag operation And as in my research, I found from the beginning traces, indications of Israeli involvement. Working from that hypothesis, over the years, I found more and more indications. And as the 9/11 cover-up developed, the cover-up began on September 11th. The crime itself initiated the cover-up and the deception. And at every step of the way in this development of the deception and the perpetration of this deception on the American people, I found that an Israeli was at a key point as an executive to make a decision, or a Zionist supporter of the current Likud government of Israel. And one of the important things to understand about this, because most Americans are not very, very knowledgeable about Israeli history or Zionist history, is that the current government in the state of Israel is headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, obviously, who is also the head of the Likud coalition. The Likud is a political party that was created in the 1970s by Menachem Begin and other members of the Irgun and other terrorist groups like Lehi, or Stern Gang. And these are people, these were Zionist terrorists that used terrorism as a tool to achieve their strategic goals. And in my book, Solving 9/11, I show how this history, how the Israelis have used this terrorism as a tool against the United States and Britain in the past, going back from the creation of the State of Israel, basically. They began using terrorism in 1946. The person who created the Likud Party, which is currently running the State of Israel today, is the person who masterminded the bombing of the King David Hotel in July of 1946. And then I show a few other examples, like the attack on the USS Liberty and the Lavon affair in Egypt, where the Israeli government has attacked American targets in order to achieve a strategic goal. And when this party came into power in 1970, this became the modus operandi. This became the way that Israel began doing business, and they tried to use terrorism to scare the West. My thesis is basically is that 9/11 was the ultimate false flag terror attack perpetrated by the Likud, perpetrated by these Zionist extremists who saw that by attacking America on American soil, they would be able to change American public opinion and create a shift whereby Americans would no longer be viewing the Soviet Union as the enemy, but they would view Islam and Arab nations of the Middle East as the new up and coming threat. And if you just look at people like Benjamin Netanyahu, who's now calling for the United States to basically be very tough with Iran, this man in 1976 became the director of the Netanyahu Institute on Terrorism. And he has been the architect of calling for the war on terror since 1979. And that is what we have inherited, and that's what we have got. And 9/11 remains an unsolved crime. My books are called Solving 9/11, and I've done my utmost to try and solve these crimes. But the fact that they remain unsolved crimes, and that our government, the United States government, has not pursued a rigorous investigation and prosecution for these crimes, indicates that we're still living under the regime that wants to keep these crimes from being solved. That's all.
Thank you very much, Chris. Okay. I'm sure that many of us are prepared with questions or maybe a brief comment. And what we'll do is go down the order in which people register for the conference, and you can ask a question if you have one, or you can just pass and go all the way around to the next person. So, Craig, you were the first. Do you have anything you want to ask or comment about? Star 6 to unmute, Craig.
Sure, Colby, were you talking to me? Sorry, Ken.
Yeah, you were the first one to register for the conference.
You want me to go ahead? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sure. Well, I can ask a question if that's... I wasn't really first on the call, but I don't mind going ahead. I wanted to ask you, I was interested, Christopher, in the section in your book about Arna Milton, the Hollywood producer who is also a Mossad agent.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a subject that I'm very interested in, the whole, you know, Hollywood films and how that they're used to sort of craft perception. And mm-hmm. I just wanted to, I guess, hear your thoughts about the use of entertainment as propaganda mm-hmm. to further the aims of elite groups. And more specifically, I'd like to know what you think about the possibility that Hollywood films made prior to 9/11 showed some kind of foreknowledge of the event, and perhaps might even have been used to prepare us to accept the official version.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. That's a very, very good question.
I'm sorry, before you respond, Craig, can you mute your phone, please, because there's still interference coming from there. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to try to get to deal with that. Okay.
Yeah, if somebody else.
Is that any better?
This is Adam Syed. I just unmuted. I'm driving.
Okay, we're okay now. Whatever you did, Craig, if you just muted, we're okay.
Okay, that's very good. That's a very, very good question. Arnon Milchan and 9/11. Arnon Milchan is a key Mossad operative. He has been involved with the development of the State of Israel, and his family is one of the founders of the State of Israel. He is a producer in Hollywood. He made the films like JFK. He produced these films. He produced Brazil, and he produced a few other films. His first film, however, his first significant project was a British-French project called The Medusa Touch. I believe it's called The Medusa Touch. It was made, I think, in 1978, and it was a film in which he spent a couple million dollars to produce this film, in which the Burton was in it. Richard Burton, I think, was in this film. But in this film, the main subject, the main person in the film, has the ability to use telekinesis. And one of the climactic scenes is of an airplane flying into a skyscraper, of an airliner, like a 747, flying into a high-rise building, like on 9/11. He made that film in 1978, and before the film was even finished, it was bought by a Lord Lew Grade, or Lev Grade, a Russian Jew who's got some peerage in Britain, and he bought the film for $5 million, which paid back all the money that Mr. Milchan had put into the film. Later in the year 2000, this Arnon Milchan was now established in Hollywood, and he was a very close business partner with Rupert Murdoch of News Corp and Fox News. They were joint owners of a company called New Regency Productions, I think it's called that. And in the year 2000, the Murdoch-Milchan company produced a film called The Lone Gunman in Vancouver, Canada, and New York. And the subject of this film, it's a TV documentary. It's a TV series, spin-off of The X-Files, in which a plane is hijacked remotely. A jetliner is hijacked remotely and flown into the World Trade Center. And in order to produce this film in 2000, they actually used helicopters and flew at night across, you know, New York skyline. And they flew at the World Trade Center in order to make this footage as realistic as possible. I hear a bit of static back there. But,
there's quite a bit of static now.
Yeah, I hear that. But the thing is that Arnon Milchan was involved with the smuggling of nuclear triggers from the United States, and he was involved in high-level Mossad operations like that. Hollywood, you know, he was making these films that very much gave the ideation, the idea, the visual image to 9/11. And the fact that this Mossad, high-level Mossad operative, made two films, both of which feature airplanes flying into the World Trade Center or World Trade Center-like building, you know, suggests to me that this man was very much part of the planning and the creation of the idea of 9/11. And the thing is that the idea for 9/11 was actually begun in Israel in the 1970s. Shortly after the Likud came to power in 1976, I think it was, these Israeli Mossad people began talking about that Americans, that the tallest buildings in New York would be destroyed by Arab terrorists. I think we have to take care of that mute process, that static problem a bit.
Okay, it definitely seems to be... it seems to be increasing, so hopefully we'll just be able to hear around it. I'm guessing it might be coming from Chris's long-distance phone. It's hard to say.
I got
or maybe we're just being jammed, okay? but anyway...
muting my phone.
Thank you very much, Chris, Craig, for that question, because that was really...
it's much better now. I want to just want to add one thing. That Arnon Milchan is very close friends with Shimon Peres, who is the father of Israel's nuclear arsenal. And he also employed Benjamin Netanyahu, the man who is now the Prime Minister of Israel. He worked for Arnon Milchan when Arnon Milchan was smuggling those nuclear triggers to Israel back in the 1980s. So you see, when we're talking about this gang, when we're talking about this Israeli gang that is involved in the prior knowledge and the planning of 9/11, we're talking about a really very small group of people. It's a few dozen people, and their names are familiar. Those whose names are not familiar are those who are working in intelligence. But on the political side, people like Arnon Milchan, Shimon Peres, Benjamin Netanyahu, Menachem Begin, these people. People know these names. These are not unknown entities. And the history that I'm talking about is nothing secret. This is a matter of public knowledge. So anybody who has read the New York Times and followed Middle Eastern history over the past 30 years would not be surprised by anything that I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Let's see who's next on the list for... That's a hard question to follow, but let me see here. Barry Zwicker, you're next.
Oh, good. Christopher, nice to be in touch with you. Remember, we spent but a very happy, interesting time together in 2005. When we were on the Jimmy Walter European 9/11 Truth Tour. So that's when I first met you, and I've followed you since. Could you track the success or the failure, Chris, of that old trope of anti-Semitism that gets thrown at you or anybody who mentions Israel in connection with 9/11. Do you think, I get the feeling that it's lost its punch a bit, but you'd be in a better position to analyze how powerful or how weakened is that charge that's trotted out so often.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it was applied against me early on by the ABL in November of 2001. After I had written an article about the eyewitness evidence of explosives in the World Trade Center, which was one of my very first articles about 9/11, the ABL put out a little brochure or something, on the internet, and they called the newspaper that I was writing for at the time anti-Semitic, but they didn't exactly call me anti-Semitic, but they tried to, I didn't understand it, but they were trying to criticize what I had written, but when I wrote about explosives in the World Trade Center, I said nothing about Israel or Jews. Now, that's an interesting thing, is that just in the last week, for example, I've been calling up these people who were involved in the telephone call with Professor Stephen Jones in Utah. When Professor Jones was attacked on a radio show, and he was asked about who he thought might be behind the attacks of 9/11. And Professor Jones said something about international banking cartel. And then when he went off the air, a couple of Jewish callers, people who were on the radio show, they suggested that Professor Jones was using code language and that he was truly anti-Semitic. And then based on these allegations, the first caller was Mr. Tomkowski, who was the head of the United Jewish Federation of Utah. He suggested that Professor Jones was being anti-Semitic. And based on these baseless allegations, Professor Jones was then suspended from teaching at BYU after 21 years of teaching physics and chemistry. So the charge of anti-Semitism is used, but unless it is really valid, unless it's really true that the person is an anti-Semite, then it's completely misused. And I spoke to one of the people that was involved in that phone call or that television radio show with Professor Jones, and he was at Northwestern University. His name was Robert Fine, I think it was, and he said that he had not followed what had happened to Professor Jones afterwards, and he found it hard to believe that Professor Jones had been fired from his job for having said that. But the charge itself is leveled against people who criticize Israel. They tried to do that with me on Fox News. They tried to do it with me on CNN. But, you know, they asked if I was anti-Semitic, and I said, no, that's ridiculous. The charge is baseless. If one is not an anti-Semite, then the charge is completely baseless. And, I mean, a person like myself or Professor Jones would certainly be the first to know if they're anti-Semitic. And neither Professor Jones nor myself are anti-Semitic, and so this charge has lost a lot of its sting. But of course, it's used all the time. I mean, these Israelis will tell you that when there's a critic of Israel in the United States, the first card they play is the anti-Semite card. That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Barry.
Before we proceed, Chris, I was wondering if you would do an experiment. If you have a cell phone or a phone where you can do the digital, would you try muting yourself just for a second and let's see what happens to the sound quality? I just want to find out if it's your phone or no. It's *6 and then *6 to get back. Thank you.
*6. Okay, let me do *6.
Yes, and there it's quiet again. So it is probably the international call that's creating the disturbance, so we know that. Okay, come on back, Chris. *6. Yeah, it looks like it's your phone that's creating the, probably just the long distance here that it can't handle, but so at least we know what the issue is. Okay.
Maybe you want to have Chris mute his phone while the questions are being asked, then unmute to answer.
That's a good idea. Would that be okay, Chris?
Yeah, here goes.
Okay. Thank you. The noise is still there, Chris, so come on back. Wait. No, it's...
I think I hear wind. Maybe everybody who's not speaking could mute. And that is it. Wait, if there's any mute or any background noise,
okay.
12 or 15
That's a great idea. Would everybody other than Chris and the person I call on, please mute yourself. And we'll find out if we can eliminate the problem that way. And you'll be called on in turn, so you won't need to be talked. Boy, that's great. That quieted it way down. This is going to be better, I think. Chris, are you still online?
Ken, let's find out. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're fine. Mm-hmm. And it's not creating any noise, so apparently it was someone else's phone that was causing the problem. That's great. All right, so we'll go to the next a questioner here. That will be Anisha is not on the call, as she took she had registered, but I don't think she's here. So, Anisha, are you here? No. Okay, so James, you're next.
Okay. Chris.
Yeah.
What would you estimate the role of Project the People and Project for a New American Century and maybe the plotters who killed the Kennedys and people like Philip Zelikow in what happened on 9/11 in addition or instead of the Mossad?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good question. Is it James?
Yeah.
Very good. That's a very good question. This is, now I need to explain a little bit of the difference between the Israelis and the Zionists in America and Britain. The thing is that Israel is a very small country and it has a very capable military and military intelligence, Mossad and other elements, other agencies. From what I have seen, what the evidence indicates to me is that the Mossad and Israeli army operate basically as the operational arm of worldwide Zionism. And worldwide Zionism, international Zionism, is basically headquartered in Britain and the United States. It's also in France and some other countries, but the main left arm, right arm of international Zionism is actually in London and New York and a few other places. Now, your question about... the indications are that Israeli intelligence, Mossad, people like Benjamin Netanyahu, people at the Amman, the highest level of Israeli military intelligence, Ehud Barak, for example, these people played highest level positions in the architecture of the crime itself. But they had behind them, they had all of these people that financed them, who support them, and who are actively involved in supporting the state of Israel from places like Chicago. Now, when you ask about the murder of Kennedy and Zelikow and this brings me very close to a subject that I'm very interested in. This is like the Crown family of Chicago. The Henry Crown and family. Henry Crown is now, the family head is now Lester Crown. This is a family that runs General Dynamics. General Dynamics was the number one defense contractor in the United States in the 1980s, having been almost bankrupt in 1960. And at that time they were headquartered in Dallas, Texas. And there was a contract for a fighter jet that they received, something like a $7 billion contract in 1961 or something. And the companies, the General Dynamics fortunes changed immensely with the war in Vietnam. And Lyndon Johnson made that war into a hot war, increased federal spending on the war. General Dynamics, which was headed by Henry Crown, and Henry Crown is not just a Zionist from Chicago. He's closely tied to the Chicago outfit. He's closely tied to the mafia. And the thing is that in Chicago, the Jews basically have run the mob for a long time. Families like the Pritzker family, Hyatt Hotels, the Crown family, General Dynamics, and a few other families like that, they are at the very top. They were like Sidney Korchak. They were the lawyers and the consiglieres for the mafia. And this is when you one has to really think like a James Bond book. When you're talking about mega criminals who in the 1950s planned to basically take over the United States. They saw this as being a project, a criminal enterprise, just like one of the mega criminals in a James Bond book. And interesting that these same people then began producing the Bond films which are not, you know, not quite faithful to the books. But the Crown family is now the fourth largest contractor. They get $16 billion a year, year after year, in federal contracts. And they own Aspen Mountain, they own Aspen Institute, and a few other things. But it's interesting, I put a piece last week on my website because I saw a film clip of Lester Crown speaking in Aspen, Colorado, at the Aspen Institute, and he's talking about how his father was a provider of weapons for Israel at a time when the U.S. was obliged to the U.S. Neutrality Act, and it was illegal to send weapons to Palestine or to Israel in the early 50s. So American law prohibited, U.S. law prohibited any weapons to go to Israel to support the Israelis or on the other side. But Lester Crown, Henry Crown, what he did is that when he saw that two companies merged, North American Aviation and another one merged, there was an entire aircraft plant that he went and bought. He was told to buy the whole thing, and the whole plant was shipped to Israel. This plant was probably in Dallas, Texas, my thinking is. I don't know for sure, because then it would have been shipped down through Mexico to Palestine, to Israel. So the Crown family and the Chicago Mafia, I believe, are tied into the Kennedy murder. And this is all because of, the Zionists. Kennedy was a threat to not just the Israeli bomb project, you know, that they wanted to throw nuclear bombs in the desert there. But he was a threat to the Israelis on a number of ways. His little brother, Bobby Kennedy, was attorney general, and he was demanding that the Israelis the Israeli lobby be considered as foreign agents and registered under the Foreign Agents Act. He wanted to shut down the CIA, but he was not gung-ho about the war in Vietnam. So you can see that when people like Henry Crown became owners of General Dynamics in 1959. You have to understand, Henry Crown made his millions of dollars during World War II as a 45-year-old lieutenant colonel, in which his sole purpose in the military was to act as procurement chief. So he had a little company in Chicago called Material Services Corporation, in which he had made himself rich by providing the city of Chicago with everything they needed, right? Sand, gravel, pencils, paper, whatever, what have you. He saw that the way to make money was to provide materials for the U.S. government. So during World War II, he was in charge of procurement for the entire Midwest in the United States for the World War II material. So they made a lot of money that way. And he said, well, this is the way to do it. So in 1959, he bought General Dynamics. Then we got the Vietnam War and the murder of Kennedy. So, you know, I think that definitely you have to consider that these families, like the Crown family, and these, you know, they made Obama. The Crown family made Obama from the time he came to Chicago. In that very same video I talked about in Aspen, Colorado, he says that they have been supporting Obama since the time he came to Chicago. And this is very much like the Klusnik family of Chicago. The richest or the most famous, most powerful Jewish family in Chicago is the family of Philip Morris Klusnik. Now, you have to ask yourself, why would these wealthy Zionist Jews of Chicago, why would they be promoting and cultivating a black man from Hawaii to be the president of the United States? The only reason that they created Obama as a candidate was that they wanted him to serve them. And so, you know, the whole thing about Obamacare, he's serving the financial elites, and he's making the insurance companies wealthy. But he is also maintaining the cover-up of 9/11. He has maintained the cover-up of 9/11 into the next administration. And in my mind, this is the real problem that has to be addressed, is that until we in the United States get a proper investigation, criminal investigation, and prosecution for the crimes of 9/11, until it happens, we are living in la-la land. We are living in an abnormal state. Because it is completely abnormal for a state to allow mass murder of 3,000 of its people in broad daylight and then to protect the culprits. That is completely abnormal. That's all.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. Ned, I think you're next on the list.
Who?
Ned Delaney? Ned, so star six if you're muted.
Am I there?
Yep,
you're mine.
Yep.
Okay, sorry. I have a question about the peace movement. If there's any experience you've had with phenomena that has taken place regarding that movement and apparent hostility, this is something I've experienced even locally with members of the peace movement and apparent hostilities towards 9/11 and the focus on those events. You've got a person like Chomsky who's been speaking out against making some rather bizarre comments, and then pursuant to this, it's kind of a two-question comment. You've got Prince Bandar that's also making comments about 9/11 truth, though he's not part of the peace movement by any means.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got the Saudi side of the Israeli. It's almost like a 1-2 punch. And I just wonder if somehow all this is tied in with even the peace movement.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense.
Mm-hmm. Very okay. Okay, Ned, thanks for the question. It's an interesting question. Peace movement, what peace movement? I mean, I grew up in the 1960s and I saw that there was a very vibrant, very active anti-war movement at that time, you know, with the music and the protests and what have you. There was a complete, I would say, anti-war subculture in the United States. And as a young person, you know, I remember my mother and father, they would say they couldn't understand for the life. I mean, they're well-educated people, but they could never understand why we were at war in Vietnam. And we were in war in Vietnam from the time that I was in kindergarten until I finished high school. And so that's a formative years of my life. The United States was involved in an undeclared war in Indochina, in Vietnam, in Laos, in Cambodia, what have you, that nobody could really explain. But, you know, like when you look at it from the point of view that there were American families, like the Crown family, that were very highly connected. You know, the Crown family is just one of many. But these families were becoming extremely wealthy by the expenditure of weapons and weapon systems and bombs and planes and what have you. I mean, I can't see of anybody else who benefited from that war besides those people. But when I talk about peace movement today, this is something that I don't understand. I don't understand why there is no peace movement. Because, you know, as a kid from the 60s and 70s, you kind of think that other people have that same kind of anti-war thinking. But the kids in this generation today, they have not read books like All Quiet on the Western Front. They have not seen the movies or heard the songs that we heard in the 60s. And they haven't read books like Farewell to Arms. So rather, they have seen, getting back to that Hollywood question, they have seen movies that glorify violence. This is the Rambo generation, the people who have seen all of these movies about how they grew up on television where you fight and shoot and kill, but you never get hurt. It's almost like a James Bond film, you know. You do all these crazy, incredible, extremely dangerous things, but the good guy never dies. I think that must be the only thing that these people must be thinking when they sign up to go off to a war in Afghanistan. You know, you think about people like Pat Tillman, the football player from San Jose, who had a $3 million contract to play for the Phoenix Cardinals or something, and he believed the 9/11 story to the degree that he nixed the contract and he signed it for the military and went over there. And, you know, as we now know, when he was in Afghanistan, he saw how U.S. troops were protecting the opium fields, and he was writing back to his mother talking about this. And then, as we know, he was shot by friendly fire. He was killed by Americans because he knew too much, and he was talking about it. But there is no peace movement because this generation of young people, the college-age people who would be the natural leaders. You know, any peace movement really has to have an army of soldiers from the universities and the you know, these institutions. And today's young people are too afraid.
They're too afraid of the government. People are have been intimidated, and people are afraid to challenge the state in America. I think that's pretty clear. People are afraid to challenge the state. They're afraid to be different from others. And there's no leadership. There's no music. There's nothing like Woodstock. You know, Woodstock's just one example. There's nothing like that. The music industry is now so consolidated that anybody who sings anything about anti-war music, you know, you just remember those Dixie Chicks, for example. They just said a comment that they were kind of ashamed of being from the same state that George Bush was from, and they were blacklisted in the industry. Well, I mean, this is what I mean. People are afraid now. They've shown what they can do. So musicians are afraid of speaking out. Actors are afraid of speaking out. People, you know, they know what happened to Vanessa Redgrave. And even journalists. Because journalists are afraid. They don't want to wind up like Michael Hastings. They don't want to wind up like Philip Marshall or like Christopher Bolin. I saw a comment the other day on Snowden's Twitter, but it's not really Snowden, where they said that you know, these people don't want to talk about the Lancet magazine in Britain, when they had discovered that Arafat had been poisoned with polonium-210, and they didn't point any fingers at, like, maybe Mossad did this, and they said that's because the Lancet doesn't want to wind up getting Chris Bolin. Well, I'm lucky that I'm fortunate that I'm still able to talk and to write, and I've written my books after the altercation I had with the undercover police came to my house. But other people have not been so lucky. People are killed. Journalists are killed in America, and there's this growing fascist mentality in America that people are afraid of challenging the state. And Chomsky and people you referred to, I think that when you talk about Chomsky, that you meant that might be the peace movement. People like Amy Goodman and Noam Chomsky. Why do they not take 9/11? You know, why do they pick up 9/11 Truth and run with it? Well, because they are part of the controlled media. Chomsky is the son of a rabbi. Amy Goodman is the son of a rabbi. And if you know anything about Judaism, you know that it is stark verboten. It is the highest crime you can do to accuse a fellow Jew of something. This is like what the Masons have and all these little groups have. The Code of Omerta and the Dean Moses. A Jew will never accuse another Jew of a crime or expose another Jew's crime for fear of being ostracized from the community. You look at what happened to Judge Goldstone, for example. Judge Goldstone, who wrote the report for the United Nations about Israeli war crimes in Gaza in 2008. He was ostracized by the State of Israel and the Jewish community, and he actually recanted. He actually came back and tried to say that, you know, I didn't really mean all those things. Israel didn't really do all those things that I wrote down in that report. Well, this is the thing. Chomsky and Amy Goodman, they will not go out and say what I say. They will not. They know that it's true. Because if anything in my book, what I say about Israel or Jews involving the 9/11, if it were not true, I would have heard about it by now. But they don't attack me on any of the essence of my book. So all they can do is maybe say, oh, he's anti-Semitic. But I'm not anti-Semitic. And it's incumbent on me to be very proper and never to say anything that can be even, you know, misinterpreted, like Professor Jones said. Because, you know, if I were to appear radical, if I were to appear to be not making sense, well, that I would be my own worst enemy, right? So I can say these things, but Chomsky won't, and the peace movement won't, because as I found out in 1990, when they had the war in Iraq, the first war in Iraq, I created a peace movement at University of California, Santa Cruz, Stanford, and Cabrillo College. And I called it was called Palestine Support Group. And I saw very early on how this message, the Palestinian message, was pushed off the table, and actually Jewish kids from the Hillel house at University of California, Santa Cruz, took over the peace movement. And so, because, you know, Israel is very much a key player in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, what have you. So the peace movement at college campuses across the United States is taken over and intimidated by the Hillel group, because every single college campus in the United States of America has a Hillel house. Hillel is part of B'nai B'rith, which is part, and Anti-Defamation League is the same. Every single police station in the United States has an ADL liaison. And that person, you know, this is how this B'nai B'rith, this secret Jewish Masonic organization, which is Zionist by nature, how they are able to reach their message, get their message out to every college campus and every police station across America. About Prince Bandar and the Saudi thing, well, the Saudis are the mammon, and Israel is the whatever it is. But as you say, these two entities, the Saudis and these Israelis, they work together in so many ways. You know, like what we see in Syria today. We see that the Qatar people, the government of Qatar, the people of Saudi Arabia, the government of Saudi Arabia is supporting these rebel movements, and Israel is involved in there, and the Saudis, the relationship between the Saudis and the United States is a very unholy relationship, and I can't say more than that, but it's not a very good thing, and Prince Bandar is a very close friend of the Bush family, and that's all I can say about that.
Thanks, Chris. Mark McDonald, you're not on the call, are you? Okay, Barbara, you're next.
Okay.
Barbara Honegger?
Yeah, hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Hello.
Can
you hear me? Can you hear me, Chris?
I hear you, loud and clear.
Oh, great. Great, okay. I have some really quick comments and then a big question. I would appreciate knowing at the outset the proper email for you,
okay.
So you could give that to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my email, the best way to reach me is Bolin, B-O-L-L-Y-N, .books, B-O-O-K-S, @yahoo.com.
Okay, that's the one I had. I just wondered if that really was yours and if you really look at those emails. Apparently you do.
Yes,
that's
I do.
Great. All right, thank you. Okay, a couple of quick comments. First off, on the question of anti-Semitism, in my mind, I'd like to know your comment on this, in my mind, Israel is the arch anti-Semite in the world, anti-Semitic organization, state in the world, because Arabs and Palestinians are Semites. And I believe that that we need to turn this boomerang, we need to boomerang this back on these arch-Zionists by a campaign, an actual international campaign to tell the truth that they are the arch anti-Semites in the world. So that's comment number one. Comment number two, if you haven't read it already, you must get a new book by Daniel Sheehan, a longtime 40-year friend and colleague of mine, called The People's Advocate. If you don't, everybody on the call, if you don't have Daniel Sheehan's new book, The People's Advocate, it is a must-read to understand what we are up against, because we'll never succeed in shifting the world back to a pre-9/11 world without understanding what is in that book. And in particular, for you, Chris, the chapter on Karen Silkwood. He was the attorney in the Karen Silkwood case. And of course, the center of that was that Israel was stealing plutonium from the Kirby nuclear power plant where she worked. She blew the whistle on that, and she was killed. So that goes together. That goes together with the with the theft, the nuclear triggers that you're talking about.
Right.
Okay. So I've got two questions. My big question and a little question. My big question is, and I'd like to have you know back and forth with you, because I have very specific ideas and visions.
Yeah.
But in the big picture,
what will it take in your mind, I'm sure you've thought deeply about it, shift the world back to a pre-9/11 world? What will it take politically in Britain, the United States, and Israel, to a lesser extent France, maybe Saudi Arabia, I give up on them, but in the so-called Western world, and Israel, which I don't consider part of the Western world, what will it take to shift back? And my other smaller question is, are you aware of the McNiven Affidavit? And it's very important, the McNiven Affidavit, former Army officer who went forth with the McNiven Affidavit about his experiences inside the Army that are directly linked to 9/11 back in 1976, the year that the Likud Party came to power in Israel. So those are my questions. Thanks so much.
Okay. I can. Your last question first, McNiven affidavit. I don't know about that, so I will have to look into that, or you can tell us more about that. I don't know about that. That sounds very interesting. So that
I will.
That
I will email. I will email you, and also send that email to the group, and Ken can get it out to everyone.
Thank you. Because there is one thing I can tell you for sure. I've worked in Washington D.C. and I've been in Washington D.C. a lot. And I used to go to Washington, D.C. as a Palestinian, you might say activist, because I was, I studied Israel and Palestine, I lived there, and when I came back to the United States in 1978, after living in Scandinavia and the Middle East, I was very discouraged and dismayed by the discourse in the United States and the amount of ignorance, and the amount of ignorance particularly at the U.S. military level and government level. And so I went to Washington, you know, several times met with all these various groups and things like that. And what I saw was that the American military brass was enamored and very closely supportive of Israel in every possible way. And I could see that the Israelis had hoodwinked the U.S. military. It's basically what it is. Israelis are very good at lying and at flattering and using all these little subtle psychological tricks to get people on their side. And I saw that they had succeeded with the U.S. military lock, stock, and barrel. And that was worrisome to me, and 9/11 is one of the reasons why I think it's very worrisome, because, you know, the military being a hierarchical institution is like so much of the U.S. government. If you control the person at the top, you control the entire organization. The most simple thing about it is that if you look at the Department of Justice on 9/11, it was headed by Mr. John Ashcroft, who was a born-again Christian but kind of goofy, very pro-Israel. But the man in charge of the 9/11 investigation was an Israeli, Michael Chertoff, who was the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice. So it was his duty, it was his obligation, it was his office's business to prosecute the crimes of 9/11. And in order to prosecute the crimes of 9/11, Michael Chertoff oversaw the investigation by the FBI, who had just received a brand new director, Mueller. Mueller had only been on the job for about 6 days or 5 days. But the point is that the hierarchical nature of the Department of Justice, whereby if the person at the top of the Department of Justice, Michael Chertoff, or the Attorney General now, you know, this guy today, Eric Holder, that means that this is the highest prosecutor in the nation. And if that person is a part of the conspiracy, how do you prosecute him? How do you prosecute the Attorney General of the United States of America? There is no higher authority than him, except the President. So, That's what I wanted to say about that. Your question says, what will it take? Your big question, what will it take to turn us back to a normal state? we can't go back to pre-9/11. We can't turn back time. But what can we do to return to a normal, functioning republic where crimes are prosecuted and justice prevails, at least, you know, some semblance of justice prevails? Well, It'll take a revolution. I can't see. We are living in revolutionary times. I put this on my website the other day under my support Boleyn thing, because, you know, I saw that these these truckers were going to do this thing around Washington D.C. last weekend, and that the vets were going to go and they were going to go back to their memorials in Washington D.C. and take a stand. And I mean, this, you know, whether these things succeeded or not, this is showing that the American people are fed up. They're fed up. You know, little by little by little by little. The American people are getting so fed up with the dictatorship in Washington, D.C. They're fed up with Obama. You know, people, I'm from Chicago, and Obama is a complete fraud. But I have to tell you that Obama was a non-entity in Chicago, where I'm from. I was in Chicago when he ran for mayor, when he ran for Senate. And many people don't understand this, but when he ran for Senate, there was no other candidate running against him. It was a one-man race for the U.S. Senate. And at the last minute, black candidate from Maryland came over just to stand in as a stand-in candidate, even though he's not even from Illinois. Well, who won the race? Obama won the race. Now, that's not the first time Obama won a race like that. See, and then you ask yourself, well, wait a minute, this is the Zionist candidate. This is the candidate that Henry Crown and the Lester Crown family have supported since he came to Chicago. This is the candidate that Philip Klutznik's daughter said will be our first black president. In 1992, she said that. So, and this is the candidate who was created by David Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel, who is now the mayor of Chicago. You know, Rahm Emanuel, for those who don't understand, is the son of a lefty terrorist, not an Irgun terrorist. Irgun is bad enough. They blew up the King David Hotel. Lefty, or the Stern Gang, they're the ones who killed Volker Bernadotte. They're the ones who killed the United Nations envoy in Palestine in a Bonnie and Clyde operation. And guess what? Rahm Emanuel's father was involved in it. This is what boggles my mind, that you can have these sons of terrorists running whole cities in America. And of course, none of this is discussed. None of this is discussed in the U.S. media. The American people in Chicago, they don't know about Rahm Emanuel's background. They don't know that Rahm Emanuel's brother, for example, is the agent for Michael Moore. Okay, so that's the only thing I wanted to say, is that it'll take a revolution. And we're living in revolutionary times. And you see the revolutions that are happening in the Arab world. The same thing is going to happen, or will need to happen, in the United States and in Britain and in France in order to kick out the criminals, kick out the corrupt regime that has controlled our country. And it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy. Look at Egypt today. They had blood revolutions, two of them, and the military took power again, because the military is the real power that is at issue here. That's all.
Thank you very much. I actually, just one last comment. I actually believe that the United States military, the rank and file of the U.S. military, who has had to be the fodder for the wars in the Middle East, that were one of the main purposes of 9/11, one of the main goals, they were actually the main audience for the 9/11 fraud. And so the U.S. military, I believe, needs to be a major focus of our 9/11 truth movement. And that's it. Thank you so much, Chris.
Yes. Thank you, Barbara. I want to say one thing. In follow-up to that comment is that 85% of the U.S. personnel in Iraq were told in a poll, said that they thought that Saddam Hussein and Iraq were involved in 9/11, although there is, of course, not one piece of evidence to indicate otherwise. This shows you two things. This shows you how strongly the media propaganda succeeded without ever actually saying that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11 by not giving out the true information or accurate information. They perpetuated this misunderstanding. When you have 85% of the people who are putting their lives on the line in Iraq believing a complete falsehood, the media has really dropped the ball. That's all I can say.
Thank you.
Hello?
Somebody has to unmute. I'm going to mute now.
Okay. Okay.
And somebody has to announce a participant.
Okay. I want to just say one thing. One thing, follow, since we have a moment of silence, I want to say one thing is that the role of the media, of the controlled media in the United States, in perpetuating the deception of 9/11 and not investigating the government charges, the government official version, tells me that the media is co-conspirators. They are co-conspirators. The heads of the Murdoch and the heads of CNN and NBC, CBS, ABC, all of these, this is a small group of people. These people are guilty of being co-conspirators in deceiving the people of the United States about 9/11 and the wars that followed. Americans have to get themselves off the TV habit, because the TV is what controls their thinking to a degree that renders them really ineffective as political players. Ready for the next question? We need another question.
Nobody's asking. I guess I'll just jump in here.
Okay. Sure.
I have two questions.
Sure.
One, I think interest of mine is the infiltration of the 9/11 truth movement. I've been involved in the truth movement since 07, and it took me a couple of years, probably by summer of 09, I was absolutely convinced that, of the infiltration issue.
Yes.
And it seems to me there are a couple of key issues that are trying to be suppressed. And I see a number of groups, such as the 9/11 Consensus Panel, the Toronto hearings, even this wonderful new movie that's come out, which I appreciate in many, many ways, that was done by an Italian filmmaker, I think it's Massimo Mazzucco. And there are certain issues. The people possibly knew that it sounds like we're getting the wind again. If everybody could mute except me right now, that would be great. Thank you.
Go on.
Hi. Sorry. Barbara, are you still speaking? I was cut off the call. Okay. Go ahead,
I'm
Barbara.
I'm asking a question actually right now.
Okay, go ahead.
There are a couple of key issues which it seems that they want to suppress. For example, I haven't actually watched all of it, so I can't say for sure, but this new film by Massimo Mazzucco, which is The New Pearl Harbor, he doesn't seem to address hard evidence around the Pentagon. He doesn't address CIT or the work of pilots, or the work of Barbara, for that matter, and doesn't address, as far as I can tell, Israeli involvement. I found the same thing when I was a regular contributor to 9/11 Blogger before I was banned, that they are absolutely against any kind of mention about Israeli involvement, and they really were very negative towards CIT and towards pilots and banned everybody who supported them. Personally, I know this is considered a fringe idea, but I personally also think that there was video fakery on 9/11, and it seems to me that this is also another issue that is being suppressed, and I think because when video fakery were widely understood, that would really drive the stake into the, I guess you could say, the heart of people's beliefs in the mainstream media, because right now, many people still believe they're getting the truth from their favorite, TV pundit. So I guess I'd just be curious to know what your take is on the infiltration issue, anything you know about how it operates, what their aims are, who the main players are. That's question number one, and question number two is pretty short. What do you see in the future? You say it's going to take a revolution. Do you think we will get that? I personally am not feeling very optimistic, but I would love to hear that I have reason to feel otherwise.
Right. Okay. Your first part of your question was about infiltration of the 9/11 movement. That's a given. Any time you're going to have such a powerful event as 9/11, and then you're going to have any sort of grassroots movement to look for the truth, just like we were talking about before, the anti-war movement. Whenever you have such movements where there are political players involved and there are big forces and big money involved, you're going to have infiltration. Like I said about how my little anti-war movement in Santa Cruz, California, was taken over by the Hillel. The Hillel boys took over the anti-war movement and completely tried to prevent any discussion of Israeli strategic goals in the first war against Iraq and the entire problem. You know, you have to remember that Saddam Hussein was giving $25,000 to the family of every Palestinian martyr who blew himself up in Tel Aviv, or whatever. So this army of martyrs and Intifada suicide bombers were being funded or being supported by Saddam Hussein. And this meant that a lot of kids were blowing themselves up to give their family a better chance, you know, a little bit of food on the table. So, you know, the Project for New American Century, people like that, they said, you know, these were Zionists, the people who wrote the Project for New American Century, this is the Taliban family. They said that Saddam Hussein has to go. Whatever happens, we have to have regime change in Iraq, and that's what we got, right? So the movement is infiltrated. The 9/11 movement is such an important movement. I saw its infiltration from the very beginning because I was part of the very first 9/11 truth seminars and symposia, what have you, across the United States. And, you know, I knew these people who were putting on these symposia, like Kyle Hentz, you know, and people like that. But I was never asked to speak. And I was only allowed to speak sometimes, like, for example, there was one event in New York, I don't know if it was Jimmy Walters event or something, where somebody didn't show up or somebody freaked out, and they said, okay, Chris, will you come up and speak? You know, you know, that's how I got invited, because people knew that what my analysis was. My analysis was not Israeli friendly. I was talking about Israeli prior knowledge and Israeli involvement in 9/11. I was talking about this from the very beginning, and that made me basically persona non grata in such groups like these 9/11 truth groups. Now, the thing is that you have to understand that such organizations, such groups will always be infiltrated. And you don't give in to that. You have to stand your ground and speak from the truth and the conscience that you have. Don't let somebody tell you, oh, no, you don't need to talk about, we're not going to let you talk. You know, you can't let yourself be bullied by some Jewish guy who's going to say, oh, no, no, we don't hear nothing about that. No, you know, you stand up and say what you have to say. And let the, you know, people have to prove the point. People have to use critical thinking. People have to use rational logic. But if you bring forth evidence, like I brought forth evidence of Israeli involvement, you know, deal with the evidence. Deal with the facts. Don't let yourself be shut up by other people. And your final question was, or your final part of your question was about the future. And if I think revolution is necessary. When I say revolution, I don't mean violent revolution. I hope and pray that we can have a revolution without violence, because violence solves nothing. It solves nothing. If you look at what happened in Egypt, for example, all those hundreds of people who were killed in Egypt or in Syria today or what have you, violence is not the answer at all, but we need to have a revolution. We need to have, like, the Declaration of Independence say, when the government shows there's a long succession of abuse and usurpations, that it is no longer serving the people or providing the security and the welfare of the people that it's supposed to be governing, then it is time for the people to make a change and to create a new government that will guarantee the welfare and the safety of the people. That's where we're at right now. And it has to happen. And people talk about, we don't have 99% following. You don't have to have 99% following. You'll never have 99% following. You know, if we can get 10 or 20% of the people to really understand that we have to have 9/11 investigated. And, you know, 9/11 is so important because 9/11 is the Achilles heel of the whole thing. You know, we can complain about Obamacare. We can complain about the NSA spying on us. We can complain about a whole host of things that the government is doing. But
9/11 is the bloody crime that we can demand answers to, and by getting those answers, we can reveal the criminal regime that is dominating our government. Because obviously, the people that perpetrated 9/11 are still pulling the threads and still controlling our government at the highest levels. They're controlling the president, they're controlling Congress, and they're controlling the Department of Justice. And until we get a revolution where those entities are changed and honest people are brought into power in those entities, until that happens, we will not solve 9/11. But this is what we have to demand. We have to demand it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Barbara. Let's move on now to Dwayne D. Mark McDonald, you're not on the call yet, are you? Mark McDonald?
That was Sheila Casey, not Barbara.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sheila. Okay, you went ahead of that. That's fine. Great. Okay. I was off the call for this, but I missed that. Dwayne Dietz, I think you've been waiting to speak. Star 6, if you're muted, Dwayne.
Yeah, okay. Let's see. I want to talk a little bit about Michael Chertoff, which already came up in response to Barbara's question. So here's an example of it.
Uh-oh. Everybody, star 6, please, unless you're Dwayne Dietz or Chris Boland. Please, star 6. Everybody, star 6, except Chris and Dwayne. Thank you.
Okay, I think this is an example of a person that played a key role both in the lead-up to 9/11 and in the cover-up. And from your book, you make a very strong case for that.
Mm-hmm.
What I find difficult in is getting, let's say, something like he was a dual citizen.
Mm-hmm.
To get some independent evidence for that,
mm-hmm.
I find it so hard to come up with those kinds of things where you can
mm-hmm.
kind of make the case to others that, yeah, there it is, and such
mm-hmm.
government record or newspaper article, whatever it is, that the public would consider viable evidence. And here's another example is that from what you're saying, he was as the, the position within the Department of Justice, number two man basically, in charge of oversight or whatever
mm-hmm.
of the 9/11 investigation. I cannot
mm-hmm.
find that as in some
mm-hmm.
independent statement. So if you can just help out on those kinds of
issues. Okay, Dwayne, thank you very much. I think you're in San Diego. And I was hoping to come to San Diego this December, but I'm going to have to make that a little bit later in the year because I definitely want to do a tour on the West Coast and do some book presentations and meet some people, you know, face-to-face. But some of my supporters here in Europe are afraid, you know, they think that if I go over there that I'll be arrested by Homeland Security and locked in a cage and I'll never be seen again. My family's one of those. But the thing is that, let's go, the question about Chertoff, these are very good questions and actually very easy to answer. I don't know if you have Solving 9/11, the original articles, or the book Solving 9/11, The Deception Changed the World. But in those books, I present this, all this information in a way that people can understand exactly what I'm saying logically and legally. Now, the point about Chertoff is that Michael Chertoff was, as you say, a very key player. He was the state attorney, district attorney in New Jersey when they had the first bombing of the World Trade Center. Was it 1993, I think. And he was involved in the prosecution of that crime, you know, with the blind sheikh and all those guys from Jersey City who were convicted of being responsible for the first bombing at the World Trade Center, where we know from simply reading the New York Times that the FBI was paying an Egyptian colonel $1 million to act as an informant. $1 million to be an informant for the FBI, and that the FBI had been involved in the creation of the bomb itself. Well, okay, that's the case that Chertoff prosecuted when he was the attorney for New Jersey. Now, about his status as a dual national. This is very important to understand. Michael Chertoff, his mother, her name was Maria Eisen. Eisen, like the German word for iron. She was originally from Czechoslovakia or Poland, something like that. She went to Israel as a girl, and she was in the Mossad. And she was became an Israeli citizen and was in the Mossad in the very beginning when Israel was in, when the Mossad was involved in bringing Jews from places like Iraq and Yemen. And they did an operation called Operation Magic Carpet, where the Israelis were able to get the Shah of whatever, the king of Yemen, to basically release or to give all of his Jews to the state of Israel. Whether they wanted to go or not, the Jews were all rounded up on airplanes and flown from Yemen, which is in the very south part of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, and they were flown via Africa, and they were flown secretly into Israel, because all of this was illegal. You know, this was, I mean, this is basically a covert operation. Now, according to the published obituary for Mrs. Chertoff, Miss Eisen, she was involved in the Mossad, and she was a key operative in this Operation Magic Carpet. So that is, so then you see she was an Israeli. By looking into the records of Mr. Chertoff, his father, and his mother, Michael Chertoff's mother, you see that his mother was an Israeli national. Now, using the law of Israel, I think it's the 1952 law of Israel, that any child who is born of an Israeli parent is, by law, an Israeli citizen or Israeli national. Their nationality is Israeli. It flows, and definitely from the case of the mother. When the mother is Israeli or the father is Israeli, the child is Israeli. And now there are these various degrees of citizenship. That doesn't mean that he's an Israeli citizen with full-fledged powers, because a full-fledged citizen of the state of Israel would then have to serve in the military, of the Israeli military. But to be a national, you can be a dual national. And a dual national would mean that Michael Chertoff is considered by the state of Israel to be an Israeli, because his mother was an Israeli. So that's basically that. By Israeli law, he knows it as well as I know, and the state of Israel, we're all in agreement that Michael Chertoff is an Israeli national. When I corresponded with his office about this, some spokesman or somebody, didn't, you know, one of his spokesmen told me that he's not a dual citizen. Now, this is, again, a play on words, because we're not talking about dual citizen. We're talking about a dual national. A dual national is a person that has a nationality, is a national of two countries. Michael Chertoff is obviously an Israeli and an American at the same time. So, now, about his position at the Department of Justice. Now, this, again, is very clear, and I make it very clear in my book, Solving 9-11. When 9-11 happened, 9-11 was a crime of terrorism. All crimes of terrorism fall to the FBI and the Department of Justice for prosecution. It does not go to the city of New York. It does not go to the state of New York. It goes directly to the Department of Justice. Now, the Department of Justice has several divisions. The criminal division is the division that investigates crimes like terrorism. The Attorney General, the Assistant Attorney General on 9-11 was Michael Chertoff, and his department was the criminal division of the Department of Justice. That is why he is the person who was, it was the obligation, it was his duty to prosecute the crimes of 9-11. Now, if you ever watch the FBI shows in the old days or something like that, you always see that the show begins with the emblem of the Department of Justice. I never quite understood that, but now, of course, it's very clear. The Department of Justice, I mean, the FBI is a sub-agency, if you will. It's a sub-agency of the Department of Justice, because it is the investigation arm for the Department of Justice. So when you have a criminal case that you want to investigate, or whatever the Department of Justice wants to investigate, the FBI is the investigative arm. And their obligation is to, obviously, to gather the evidence, to examine and analyze the evidence, and produce this evidence for the Department of Justice so that the prosecution can go forward. Now, when we talk about 9-11, as we know very clearly now, 12 years later, there has been no criminal trial for 9-11. Nor has there been no tort litigation trial for 9-11, nor will there ever be a tort litigation trial, because every single case has been settled out of court. the last one being Ellen Mariani, which also happened to be the first case. Her case has now been solved out of court, so there are no more families out there who have a claim, a wrongful death claim. So that means that the whole process in the New York, in the District Court of Lower Manhattan, under Alvin K. Hellerstein, that the entire tort litigation, in which there were 96 families left, they have all been settled out of court. Now, I mean, this is mind-boggling. In a litigious society like America, you have 96 families that have standing in the court, and not one single case goes to trial. So this is obvious because they did not want any case to go to trial. But so there I told you, Michael Cherikov is an Israeli national, and he was responsible for the investigation of 9/11. The investigation of 9/11 is what I call a non-investigation, because that's all you can call a criminal investigation when the evidence is destroyed rather than examined. If you remember at the World Trade Center, we'll just take the World Trade Center for now. At the World Trade Center, all that was left was dust and steel. Okay? The dust, we'll talk about that another time. The steel is what was remaining at the site. Now, the FBI, if they acted at all like they do on television, the FBI would have taken the dust samples from all over Manhattan, would have analyzed the dust using spectrometry and all kinds of fancy techniques. They would have found the mantle thermite that Professor Jones found, and they would have found it in the first week. And if they had taken the steel evidence from the ground zero, all those twisted girders and melted girders and molten steel and molten iron that they found, if they had analyzed that, they would have understood that the building was exploded using explosives, nanothermite, and God knows what else was used. But there is evidence of nanothermite and thermite in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And obviously there were very extremely powerful explosives as well. But the FBI didn't do an investigation. And this is all because of Michael Cherikov. So when you talk about Michael Cherikov as being a key player in the cover-up, he is the key player. And Michael Cherikov, if there were any justice in our country today, Michael Cherikov would be arrested today. And he would be investigated, interrogated, to find out who was really behind 9/11. But he is a key player in the cover-up. And that this man is allowed to appear on TV, and then they just give him softball questions, and that this man has any position in the United States government at any time is outrageous. This man is a huge criminal. That's all for me.
Thank you.
Hey, can I just jump in here? This is Adam Syed. I have to leave the call in a couple minutes to change. And
sure, Adam. You want to go ahead and ask a question before you leave?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
This is sort of along the same lines as what Sheila brought up with regard to gatekeeping and infiltration. Chris, you know, obviously, who Kevin Ryan is, right?
Yeah.
And he wrote a book recently called Another 19, in which he points the finger at who he believes are legitimate 9/11 suspects. And it seems like he points the finger at just about everybody except Israel, and in particular, he has a page on there in toward the end of the book where he just says, Israel has also been discussed as being another party behind the 9/11 attack. Unfortunately, such claims are grounded in weak evidence and poor logic and reasoning. Given how false that statement is and how much evidence there really is pointing to Israeli involvement perhaps as the central source of... You know, what are your words? How would you respond to that? And if Kevin Ryan were on this call right now, what would you say to him?
No. Well, thank you, Adam. That's a very good question. I have tried to reach Kevin Ryan on numerous occasions because of his work in 9/11, his early work. And I would have to check. I may very well have sent him my books to his address in Indiana or wherever he was. I know I have tried several times to reach him, and he has never responded to me. You know, I give out these very nice offers. I even write letters to people. I send them nice emails. I send them pictures of books. I offer to give them books for free. My books, the Solving 9/11 books, thanks to a doctor friend of mine, a supporter, I have sent the Solving 9/11 books to over 100 universities across the United States. That's a lot of people. And they have gotten both books. And so these books have been in universities across the United States. They're at the Naval War College. They're at the Army War College. They're at Northwestern. They're everywhere. They're at Harvard, Yale, you name it, from Washington to Florida. Whether he's got a book, I think he may have. But he stood right there. This is a man who is much more comfortable pointing the finger at American culprits, U.S. culprits in the U.S. government, you know, Cheney, Bush, what have you. I don't know. Is Michael Chertoff on his list? Michael Chertoff, as we just said in the previous question, should
no,
be
he's
number
not.
One
and
on the
Larry
list.
Larry Goldstein gets a pass, too.
Yeah, well, there you go. There you go. I mean, I try to make this very, very simple for people to understand. But if the crime of 9/11, as I explained, one of the key elements in any false flag operation is the control of the investigation, access to the evidence, and the litigation that follows. And when you see, that's why, you know, this 9/11 saga has had to go to full maturity, if you will. It had to mature over a period of years before we could really see who's behind it. But, you know, you ask yourself, why would Michael Chertoff, an Israeli nationalist, son of Mossad, and Alvin Hellerstein, Judge Alvin Hellerstein, who oversaw the Pittsburgh litigation, and Mukasey, and a number of other people in my book, why would these diehard Zionist devotees, these people who are dedicated to the state of Israel, why would they be involved in the cover-up and the obstruction of justice that followed if they weren't doing it for the state of Israel? If they weren't doing it for those Zionist brethren, who were they doing it for? And for Kevin Ryan, he obviously feels much more comfortable pointing the fingers at people like George Bush and these people who are really not, they were really not the architects of 9/11. They were, you know, senior politicians, but as we know in America today, senior politicians are part of the puppet show. They are not the ones who are making the decisions. And Kevin Ryan, unfortunately, seems to be a person who, for ethnic reasons or religious reasons or for some other reason, is not comfortable looking at the evidence of 9/11. If he were open and honest, he would at least accept my books and read the books or look at them and judge them on their merits. But
give him the courtesy of a reply, because I have the same experiences that he just does not respond. You know, I was his Facebook friend, and then I posted something promoting the citizen investigation team on his wall, and he promptly deleted it and unfriended me. And when I inquired, never got a response, and he never communicated with me again.
Well, thank you. That's a very interesting observation.
So, anyways, thanks so much. I really do have to get changed and get on stage. I wish I could listen to the whole call.
Thank you, Adam.
Okay, thank you. Take care, everybody.
You okay? Thanks, Adam. Lorenzo, you're next. Lorenzo, *6 to unmute. *6.
Lorenzo.
Hi, Lorenzo. Are you there? Lorenzo, going once. *6 if you're muted, Lorenzo. Just press *6 on your keypad. It will unmute you. *6. Going once. Going twice. Okay, then, Gerhard Betting, you would be next. *6 to unmute if you're muted. *6. Gerhard?
Gerhard Betting.
Hi,
oh,
I'm
Gerhard.
Awfully sorry. This is Lorenzo.
Lorenzo.
I was unable to get unmuted.
Go ahead.
Hi.
You're first, and then Gerhard, you're on deck.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, I'd like to disclose that I am the son of two Jewish parents, and I have no problem calling a spade, no matter who is involved. I have first I'd like to make a statement, and it has to do with the one particular event on 9/11 and how it was, you know, how I believe that it was accomplished. And I'd like to get your feedback on this, Christopher. The Dave Von Cleef, in Plain Sight, asked a question regarding the visible flash, as even, you know, the flash as the Now Day Brothers video was being filmed. You showed this flash, and he asked if it could have been an incendiary. And my allegation is that the fireball was planned by the people that produced 9/11. It was not an accident, and there's an article I got in Crash Test Fire in a website called Crash Test Fires, which states that jet fuel may ignite when it comes into contact with hot surfaces. And my allegation is that even this detail, I just haven't seen anyone else covering this potential detail, this idea that, you know, this was not an accident in either case of either of the aircraft striking the towers.
Right.
It's something I've been wanting to share with the community for a long time, and at this point here I can just sort of sit back and let it go.
Well, Lorenzo, that's an excellent question. Thank you very much. It's a very good question. Now, you know, I have done a lot of research on depleted uranium in 2004. I wrote a series of articles about depleted uranium, and I had a lot of contact with the military, and I worked with a scientist in Livermore, a former scientist in Livermore, an older fellow who worked on the Manhattan Project. He's been with him all along, from the very get-go in Chicago. His name was Marion Folk. And he taught me a lot about depleted uranium. Now, and I also worked with Doug Rocky, and who was involved with the military's testing of depleted uranium munitions down in Utah, Dugway, and Nevada, what have you. And they told me, they introduced me to exactly understanding how depleted uranium warheads work. Now, what that video you're talking about, the fireball in buildings 1 and 2, were both preceded by, as both planes struck the towers, you clearly see a bright flash. And now, of course, this event is happening very quickly, and these video cameras can only produce so many frames per second. But in both videos, we very clearly see a white flash and striking, hitting the tower just milliseconds before the plane hits. What is this? Well, when we see Flight 175 upside down in Dave Von Kleist's film, we also see this white object underneath the plane and moving faster than the plane and hitting the building just before the plane. And we talk about missile pods, what have you. Well, my understanding, what I think we're seeing, is we are seeing there were indeed missile pods beneath both planes. These planes were not the planes they were said to be, Flight 175 and Flight 111. These were drones, military drones, that were equipped with a missile pod which fired a depleted uranium, a UU warhead missile, like a, I don't know, Hellfire or whatever. There's many missiles they make in this variety. And when depleted uranium missile warhead munition flies through the air, it is pyrophoric. That means it's already burning white hot because the contact with the air and the kinetic energy make it this flaming white hot object. And that object, that depleted uranium, is so hot that it will go through anything. It will go through a tank, it will go through a boat, it will go through a plane, it will go through a building. So what I think what these depleted uranium warheads did is that they struck just before the nose of the plane struck. They opened up a hole. Obviously, they opened up a hole, which facilitated the fuselage of the plane to enter the building, because that's a very weak structure, actually. And they created, as they flew through the building, they went through columns and walls and anything that stood in their way. And they created a superheated environment. The superheated environment of this depleted uranium, it's incredibly hot. It's like, I don't know, 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, so that whatever goes in there that's combustible will burn immediately. So you're talking about this instantaneous combustion of the jet fuel. Well, yes, because as the jet fuel, you know, pulse was atomized and spread into the building, it was into a superheated environment, it combusted immediately. So we saw these massive fireballs, these Hollywood fireballs. Everybody predicted that we saw, you know, on these various DVD covers and what have you. This is Hollywood. This is pure Hollywood. But you have to have that depleted uranium to act as the detonator, to act as the ignition. You see, that is what provided that spectacle. Now, when in about 2005 or 2000, yes, about 2005, I was thinking, well, if a depleted uranium warhead was in fact fired, for example, at Building 2, then I said we would have to see something coming out the other side. Now, this is where I tell you, if you look at any video, watch the videos of the plane hitting, supposedly 175, striking the South Tower. You see the plane hit, You see the combustion of the fireball, and you will see coming out the far side of the building two objects flying very fast. Now, these two objects, one is burning white hot and leaving behind a black trail, and one is burning a different color, like grayish, and not really burning, but leaving smoke trail. Two very distinctive objects. One is burning white hot. This is, I think, our depleted uranium warhead, which then landed on that Burlington coat factory. It landed over there in that coat factory where they later, just recently, said they found a landing gear. But it's not landing gear, or a jet engine, is not going to burn white hot. And the only thing that's going to burn white hot is something that's at that temperature range that produces white flame. This is the uranium warhead. And you know, it's interesting, I wrote a great deal about this. You can look under my name, Bolin, and Missile, and Depleted Uranium, and South Power, and I have very long articles about it, but that one of the engineers who was doing research on the Astana, I think his name is Astana, he's from Berkeley, California, he's an Iranian fella, he's an engineer, he showed a picture, he showed a piece of one of the support columns from way up there in the, you know, the central columns of the 82nd floor or whatever, way up there at the top of the South Tower, and it has a hole in it. It has a hole about a 3-foot diameter, I think, or 4-foot diameter hole, completely cut out of this core column. Well, and he speculates that a jet engine did that. No, a jet engine didn't do that. That's what depleted uranium did. It cut right through that and went right out the other side. So that's what I would say about that. That's a very good question.
Chris, I'd like to make another comment, which is an allegation and something due to the studies. And I've noticed all the details, the white projectiles passing through the building. But there's another anomaly, which I've asked a lot of people. And whenever I say, look at pictures of this, what do you see? They say, we see the fireball or we see a shadow on the other building. And yeah. I allege that dark smoke trail was the shadow of the white smoke trail. My allegation is that there may have been depleted uranium used, but white phosphorus is another extremely effective incendiary, and there are all these white, you know, literally a white shroud descending around the building, and you can see all these tiny, sparkly particles on both sides. Actually, in the No Day Brothers film, in one of their close-up zooms, you can see all these like bright, sparkly particles, which is also an indicator of white phosphorus.
Yeah, a very good question. And I want to say one other thing about that is that I've done because thermite has a unique characteristic as well. What I think happened is that you talked about those fireballs being prepared. Yes, both planes flew into computer centers. Both planes flew into secure computer rooms in the first building in the south building and the south tower. And what we see when the first plane hits the north tower, you see coming out the left side of the building. It's like a huge bale of cotton. It's completely white smoke, white smoke like a bale of cotton. It looks like that.
Yes.
And I submit to you, I believe that is the aluminum oxide of a thermite, of a massive thermite reaction. Because when they do these kinds of things, you see, thermate is a derivative, another product of thermite, where you add, I think it's sulfur and barium. But what that does is it produces, just like a Hollywood spectacle incendiary, it produces a light orange flame, and it produces this white smoke. Because so this is what we saw in both towers. You know, in the South Tower, for example, this room was full of these huge, huge boxes that were said to be batteries for the computers, but as the person who worked in that department told me, they were never plugged in. Well, these, I believe, were probably packets of thermate, you know, very substantial, heavy amounts of this stuff. Just like you would do in Hollywood, if you're going to do a scene like that, a spectacle, you have to put in the explosives, you have to put in the incendiaries. And that's what we saw. And because you see, when you see the dark smoke with the dark orange flame, that is the kerosene. That's the jet fuel burning. But when you look at the North Tower and South Tower being hit, you have massive explosions coming out the entry wound, the entry point. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense because the plane is going 500 miles an hour And what is producing this explosion that comes back at you, this is the pre-planted explosive. And then you look at the color of the flame. The color of the flame is light orange. Well, what's exploding this light orange? It's not jet fuel. It has to be an explosive. And what is producing the white smoke? It's not drywall. It's aluminum oxide. So this is the thing. It's like I've written several articles. You can look under my name in my book, Who Put Thermite in the World Trade Center, or Thermate, and you'll see those articles and the pictures, because the pictures say 1,000 words. Much better, you know, these both impact zones were prepared, thermite, and that depleted uranium warhead is what set it all off. That's what I submit to you happened. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christopher.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Lorenzo. And so, Gerhard, you're up next. Go ahead. Gerhard, star six, if you want to ask your question, if you're muted, star six.
Gerhard Zetting.
Yeah, are you there? Gerhard? Well, he was there a minute ago, I thought.
Ken, in the interest of time, if somebody's not there, why don't you just move on to the next person and go back to that person?
I will, Barbara, if you'll give me a second to give them a chance to unmute. Is that okay?
That was Sheila.
Or Sheila, okay, I'm sorry. Sheila, whoever. Okay, just take it easy here. We got time for everybody to ask at least one question. That's what we said we would do. So I just want to make sure that Gerhard doesn't get excluded here, because I think he was just on a second ago when it was Lorenzo's turn. I want to make sure he had a chance to come back. But if he doesn't, Robin, you want to go ahead and ask your question? Robin Horton, star six, if you want to ask a question.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. You're up.
Hi, Christopher. Robin Horton here. This is a privilege. Thank you for taking your time out. I would like to make a couple of points. I want to, first of all, support your observation and analysis that the peace movements were infiltrated by Zionists. I ran into this in Reno, Nevada in 2001 when I started my civil informationing program, and I also ran into it smack dab all the way along, and certainly it culminated in a very fraudulent 9/11 Truth Slant peace get-together at MIT, Chomsky's place, a few years ago in Boston. That was a real thing set up to embarrass the 9/11 Truth community. So there's a reason for that, and this is what I have deduced over the years. Why would Zionists infiltrate and destroy the peace communities in the United States of America? I give you and accept the point that it's a very powerful group, and it is infiltrated and needed to be muted. Well, here's the story from my view. When the United States is not at a public war, and we have a peace community that is still vibrant, it's going to look around the world at warring, occupying situations. And then what they would do is they would say, well, let's obviously look at Israel-Palestine. Well, you know darn well that that's the last subject that the Zionists want to be brought up in the United States of America, the truth about Israel-Palestine. So all of the things that you're saying about the infiltration, the control, the kind of the manipulation of our systems, our groups, organizations, politics, whatever, military politics, whatever, this is part of the program. That is by design. What you found at Santa Cruz and elsewhere, I found elsewhere across the country, and I tip my hat to San Diego, okay, 9/11, because they seem to have been able to meld the peace community and the 9/11 truth community beautifully. Elsewhere, it has been, by design, infiltrated and destroyed, and the Zionists clearly wanted to infiltrate the 9/11 truth community, obviously, because they didn't want to talk about Israel. And they acted out to build the barrier and the gap between the 9/11 truth community and the peace community, starting in Washington, D.C. And we have had people in Washington, D.C. at such meetings of the peace communities where this information has been told. So you are right on track. You are not at all out of line regarding the infiltration of the peace communities, meaning they opposed each other and they self-destructed. That is by design. So kudos, and I pat you on the back for that and support you wholly. But the point I'm going to ask you about is to fill in a little bit. I was really thrilled to receive in the mail Global Research's article about the Greater Israel Project, and it was ended up being some type of a report or rendition on a fellow named Oded Ginon, and I may not say that right, but a strategy for Israel in the 1980s. And this closed the 9/11 circle for me. This is it, okay? Mm-hmm. Because when I read that, Anon's, their point, the Greater Israel Project, was to expand Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates, okay,
mm-hmm.
needed smaller, not larger, either countries or groups of people or whatever, to be able to pick off one at a time. And when the Middle East was, you know, when somebody made a mistake and gave the British crayons and a map, okay, when that was divided up like it was, that was exactly opposite of what was needed for Israel to succeed with the Greater Israel Project, because Israel was going to pick off one or two of the small things at a time. All of a sudden, we had countries, and Israel was stuck. So what was their plan? Their plan was to get the United States on the ground in the Middle East with troops, okay, and then eventually, as we have seen in Egypt and Syria and all over the place, we're seeing factions reemerge that aren't associated with the new boundaries, okay, that have been established by 47, I don't even know what date it was,
mm-hmm.
but those new boundaries. So to me, it's like obvious. It's obvious what the whole thing on 9/11 was designed to do. George Herbert Walker Bush got to Baghdad, but he backed out. That wasn't good enough, okay? Israel needed U.S. to fight this war, to kill Muslims, to lay out DU, and if anybody needs to know about Israel's involvement, and they understand what happens at DU and the genetic, you know, next generation of birth and stuff like that, to me, it's a complete connection. The Greater Israel Project closes the circle on 9/11, and I think it exposes Israel at overreaching on 9/11. Do you have any background, since you're so studied in that, that would either dispute or enhance my point about the Greater Israel Project? Because I'm in the streets with it right now, man. I got signs and handouts. I'm having a blast. So, thank you.
Well, Robin, thank you very much, Robin. I have to tell you that your civil informationing project is very inspiring, and I'm trying to do the same here. I need to do speeches. I need to try to inform the public, but it's a little bit more difficult for me in Sweden and Scandinavia. But it's a great thing what you're doing. Now, you're absolutely spot on, absolutely right on. The Greater Israel Project is, as you say, the concept of Greater Israel is that Israel, this is the ideology of the Likud party, exactly the people that are controlling the state of Israel today. They have this ideology that Greater Israel will grow to the size of its biblical boundaries, what they read, how they see Israel, extending from the Euphrates to the Nile, basically from Iraq to Egypt. And that is what they consider to be their legitimate domain. That's Eretz Israel. That's the land of Israel in their warped idea, okay? Now, the people who are pushing this idea are people like Benjamin Netanyahu, whose real name is Milakovsky, whose father was born in Warsaw, Poland. So, you know, what right Mr. Milakovsky has to the Holy Land of Israel, God only knows. But, you know, they have this, that's what, these are the people I call extremist Zionists, Zionist extremists. These are people who are not looking just for a safe haven for the Jews. They're looking for Greater Israel from Iraq to Egypt. Okay? This is the ideology of the Likud party. This is the party that controls the state of Israel today. Now, about the idea of Oded Ginon, this is the Israeli strategic planner who wrote this document back in the late 70s. It was printed and published. It's been published in Arab newspapers or Arab websites in America. Because what this document calls for, the strategic plan of the state of Israel, is the Balkanization. That's the best word that I can apply to this. Where, just as they did in Yugoslavia, you take a bigger country like Yugoslavia, where there are ethnic divisions, you increase
increase the divisions between the ethnic groups, you exacerbate the tensions, and then you break the entity into ethnic statelets, just like Yugoslavia. So where you had one country before of multi-confessional, multi-ethnic country, like Yugoslavia was, a very successful country, really, to be true, is now divided into nine little ethnic statelets that are all like Kosovo and Montenegro. They're weak. They're dominated. They are at the mercy of the IMF and whoever, you know, they have nothing. I've been to Yugoslavia since 9/11, I mean, since this breakup, and every single one of those states is poorer, significantly poorer than it was during Yugoslavia time, with the exception of Slovenia. Okay, now, this is what they want to do in Iraq. This is what they want to do in, so you see, every day, in every single day of the week, there is a bombing in Iraq in which 50 people are killed. It's like, you know, 50 people a day in a population the size of the state of California. That is amazing. I mean, this is what the United States occupation has brought to Iraq. Terrorism, sectarianism, division of society, because this is the Israeli plan. The Israelis want to break it into a Sunni statelet, a Shiite statelet, in the top of Kurdish state, you know, and break it up politically so that it's just fragments. And each fragment is an ethnic group. In this way, you see, the Middle East would be an area of ethnic groups in which the Jews would prevail because they're the strongest ethnic group. You know, Israel is an ethnic state. They keep telling us that, you know, we have to accept Israel as a Jewish state. The Palestinians have to accept that Israel is a Jewish state. This is basically saying that we have to accept an ethnic state, a state based on ethnic idea, an ethnic line. Now, this is very un-American. So for Americans to say, oh, yeah, it's fine, you can have a Jewish state, this is basically a complete contradiction of what American values are. We believe in one man, one vote. You know, we don't say that we have a white state in Illinois and a black state in Alabama, what have you. No, you know, modern democracies, and you know, do not discriminate on basis of ethnicity or religion. But this is what they want to do, and they're trying to do it in Egypt. They're trying to do it in all across the region. They try to do it in Lebanon. They try to do it. This is their plan, and this is who's really doing the bombs in Iraq. We know that the intelligence agencies from Britain and Israel and probably the United States are involved in sectarian bombings in this country. You know, it's what has America brought to Iraq? Nothing but anarchy, destruction, and sectarianism. The country has been so devastated. Same thing with Afghanistan. But you see, that's what they want to do. They want to fragment the Middle East, break up the big countries, and create it so that the whole region is a bunch of little balkanized ethnic statelets, and then Israel will reign supreme over the whole thing. This is the madness of the Likud ideology. This is where they want to go. And if we don't stop them, they will succeed in doing it because they control our politicians. Whether we're in Britain or the United States or Canada or Germany, they control our politicians. And because they are the stronger collective, they will accomplish this. You see, in the 12 years since 9/11, they have accomplished their agenda. We have not. We have not got an investigation of 9/11, but they have accomplished what they wanted to accomplish. That's why Solving 9/11, my book, is just as relevant today as it was if it had come out in 2002. Because until we turn around, until we stop that, I have an article on my website, a German perspective on the Zionist, you know, the Zionist treachery behind 9/11, and because this German man, he understands. It's like Nazism. If Nazism was allowed to go and go and go until it snuffed itself out by the war of World War II. But Zionism is the same thing. Zionism is an ideology that is based on war and conquest. They want to conquer the region. They want to control the assets. This is where people like the Rothschilds and the big financiers and Zionist financiers in London and New York come in. Because they're the ones who profit by their ownership, their monopoly ownership of the assets, the mineral assets of the Middle East. That's what it's all about. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, and what I will say to you, Christopher, here is I'm getting great success. The people in the United States of America, because of the blackout on really the truth about Israel and information about Israel-Palestine and the discussions that we're talking about, They're suspicious, but they're not firmly aware. I'm getting great mileage by putting out into the street just the simple name, the Greater Israel Project, on my signs, and I just say Google it, because it all makes sense. And I get a lot of people coming up to me on the streets with my big signs, because I haven't quit hitting the streets. Yay, San Diego! And I get people approach me and say, we're fighting Israel's war. So the information is out there. And this revolution, whomever thinks the revolution isn't on, it is on. It's just not quite visible.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Robin. Now, before we figure out what we're going to do next, has anyone come on the call that did not get a chance to speak yet that would like a chance to ask for a question?
Yes.
Who's that?
Jim Fetzer.
Jim, I beg your pardon. Okay, well, I don't think you answered up when we did the roll call, but okay. I know you were on the call, so go ahead, Jim.
Well, I did. Now, about the peace movement, I mean, Christopher may be unaware, but Clear Channel blacklisted over 200 songs traditionally associated with peace movements in this country since Vietnam, songs by Peter, Paul, and Mary, John Lennon, Bob Dylan, and the like, 200 songs. They then controlled 1,200 stations. They may control as many as 2,000 today. And the reason that's so significant is because a movement of any kind requires emotion and motivation. And by cutting off, you know, association with these traditional songs, they really did a brilliant job of eclipsing the emotions and motivation that are required to sustain or motivate a movement of this kind. So I think his work, Christopher's work, is more important than the work of, say, the Judy Wood Research Group or A&E for 9/11, because it talks about the who was responsible and why, and regardless of Kevin Ryan's belated effort to say some things about this, that has been a glaring inadequacy of their work. The American people, to understand 9/11, need a narrative. They need to understand how it all fit together into a big picture, which is why Art Olivier's Operation Terror is such an important documentary and why no one is willing to show it. It's because it gives a coherent narrative about 9/11. Now, I believe Christopher's politics about 9/11 are exemplary, and my own research and that of others with whom I collaborate has led us to the very same conclusions. The best summary being an article I co-authored with Preston James, PhD, on Veterans Today, where Preston is a social psychologist, entitled Peeling the 9/11 Onion, Layers of Plots Within Plots, where, you know, even on the first day, they were showing this archival footage of Palestinians rejoicing, reporting that the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine had claimed responsibility, all this other rubbish. And I believe what Christopher says about the politics is impeccable. On the other hand, the science has to be done properly, and it's a core condition of scientific reasoning, known as the requirement of total evidence, that it has to be based upon all of the available relevant evidence. Now, I have done collaborative research with T. Mark Hightower, who's a chemical engineer. He happens to work for NASA, but that's incidental, where we went through the scientific literature on nanothermite and discovered that it simply does not have the explosive capabilities attributed to it by the 9/11 Steve Jones people. And bear in mind, Steve and I go way back. When I founded Scholars in December of 2005, I invited Steve to be my co-chair. But by June already, I was skeptical that nanothermite could perform all the feats he was attributing to it. I even asked him in the lobby of the Sheraton Hotel in Los Angeles when Alex Jones was organizing the American Scholars Conference whether he believed it had the capability to do all the things he was claiming, pulverized concrete, decimate steel, and all that. And he assured me with great confidence that, yes, it could. But it turns out that nanothermite has the highest attributed detonation velocity of only 895 meters per second, and that it's a law of material science that in order to destroy a material, you must have a detonation velocity equal to or greater than the speed of sound in that material. The speed of sound in concrete is 3,200 meters per second, and steel 6,100 meters per second. Which means that while nanothermite may have played a role here and I have myself suggested some alternatives for that role. It cannot have been the primary cause of the destruction of those buildings, which are blowing apart in every direction from the top down and being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. Now, when I organized the Vancouver hearings in June of 2012, we received multiple presentations about additional research, especially related to the U.S. geological dust samples, which I was astonished to learn because I, like most of the public, had been under the impression that Steve Jones, Kevin Ryan, Neil Terrett, and all that had done a thorough study of the dust. But it turns out that these samples, which were very large and varied in their character, included all sorts of indications that this had been a nuclear event, including barium, strontium, thorium, uranium, lithium, lanthanum, yttrium, chromium, tritium, about which now I have published 4 or 5 articles in Veterans Today with the others who are doing research on this. It's also the case that the first responders have suffered all kinds of diseases, illnesses, multiple myeloma, for example, other unusual cancers, including non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, leukemia, thyroid, pancreatic, brain, prostate, esophageal, blood and plasma cancers. And that as of March of 2011, no less than 1,003 first responders had died from various cancers. Now, all this is a mountain of evidence indicating that 9/11 was a nuclear event. And what I find from the Judy Wood Group and the A&E Group is they're not even willing to acknowledge the existence of this evidence, which is profoundly anti-scientific and unprofessional. I would go a bit further and say, Christopher, in regard to your analysis of the planes hitting the towers, actually, your characterization is not even physically possible. The North and the South Tower planes allegedly were intersecting with 7 floors in the case of the North, 8 floors in the case of the South. For each floor consisted of a steel truss filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete. We know what happens to a plane when it hits a small bird weighing a few ounces in flight. Tremendous damage. Imagine what would have happened to a plane encountering just one of these trusses, where because the floors are 208 on a side, we're talking about an acre of concrete apiece. It would have been physically impossible for any real plane to enter effortlessly into those buildings with or without your depleted uranium scenario, without crumpling its wings, tail, body seats, and luggage falling to the ground. We have photographs and studies from the ground beneath. You could have reclined in a lounge chair and sipped Mai Tais while these events were going on because no debris fell to the ground. Now, I'm a huge fan of your work. And I, too, along with Alan Zabrowski and Gordon Duff and Kevin Barrett, have been targeted as the anti-Semitic 9/11 conspiracy theorists by the ADL. They have published articles attacking us, including me, at least on 2 different occasions. So, I mean, I think your politics are impeccable, but that your science needs to be brought up to date. And just to say a source about this, in addition to the multiple articles I've published on Veterans Today about this, is at the Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference, which you can find also, just do a search on the Complete 9/11 Truth Conference, Midwest Truth Conference, because during that 3-hour presentation, we began by showing A&E's explosive evidence. Then I offered a critique of A&E and talked about the fabrication of all four of the crash sites. And then finally, Wayne Mastin talked about 3 different assassinations of individuals that appear to have been involved in the cover-up. But the point I want to make here is also from an emotional point of view. Talking about a technical issue like nanothermite or even depleted uranium isn't going to arouse the American public. But if they believe the media was used to deceive them about something as basic as whether planes hit the Twin Towers, or that the Twin Towers actually were nuked on 9/11 using a very sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes that can be shaped upwards to bring about the simulation of a destruction of the building that looks somewhat like a collapse. So if you compare Building 7, which was a bona fide collapse with the Twin Towers, Building 7 isn't blowing apart in every direction. Building 7 doesn't have the floors waving their turn. Building 7 has a massive pile of debris where the Twin Towers were destroyed below ground level. So I say, look, I commend your work. I think you're doing a great job, but that you like all the rest of us, when we encounter new evidence, have to revise our beliefs to accommodate the new evidence, which may entail rejecting beliefs we previously accepted, accepting beliefs we previously rejected, and leaving others in suspense.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Okay. You basically are making two points there. One is that you're saying that there was nuclear bombs were somehow used, micro nukes were used, and that no planes were involved.
It was a very sophisticated deception, and there were witnesses who saw what they took to be planes, but they were performing feats that no real plane could perform.
Let's give Chris a chance to respond here.
About the nuclear issue first. I would submit to you that if you have the evidence and the analysis and the hypothesis developed to the point that you seem to have it, then you should present it as a scientific paper and put it up for peer review in the same way that Professor Jones did and the other people did with their nanothermite paper, so that it can be critiqued by people in the scientific community to determine, you know, its validity or not. Do the same thing that Professor Jones did with his analysis and his evidence, and let the scientific community decide the merits of your argument. And basically, I would say the same thing about your contested, what you say that there were no planes involved. I have seen the videos of various photographers from different angles, and we saw this object, this plane, strike South Tower, and we saw this, as I said, this debris flying out very fast off the other side. Are you saying that, you know, that what we're seeing is not what we're seeing, that no plane actually struck the South Tower, no plane actually struck the North Tower, and these jet engines and these things that were found in the street and the footage of the thing flying out? If no plane struck the South Tower, did they have a cannon? Did they have a cannon there launching out these projectiles out the other side? I don't understand. I don't understand how you can say that there were no planes involved on 9/11 in the North Tower and South Tower. Clearly, there were planes involved. But now, you know, if you want to do a test to see what a plane will do flying at that velocity with that mass, and now the thing is that you know that the perimeter columns of the South Tower were strong, but they were not so strong that they would prevent the plane from entering, and the mass of those wings and the plane, I suppose it could enter the building. It could go through that glass, especially when there's been a hole rendered, you know, before the plane entered. The mass and the velocity, it would go into the building, you know, and it would tear those columns.
You're just wrong, my friend. I mean, we have plenty of video of the plane halfway into the building. There's no damage to the building whatsoever. It's a violation of Newton's third law. The effect of a plane that is hitting a stationary building at 500 miles an hour would be the same as a stationary plane being hit by that 500,000-ton building traveling 500 miles an hour. It would have been smashed. Now, I'm not asking you to accept it based on our conversation here and now. I'm saying, look at some of the evidence I have presented. For example, in 1 hour, you can find, and you mention Rocky. He was there. Doug Rocky commented on what I had presented, and he was endorsing what I was saying. So if you believe in Doug Rocky, he was there. This happened in Urbana just on the 22nd of September. Just look at the evidence. It covers both the nanothermite and what's wrong with that hypothesis. And why we have to take into account all of the available evidence, which they are manifestly doing, but I'm hoping that you will at least be open-minded to consider.
Jim, let me ask you, Jim Fester. I accept that you must have read the paper, the Jones paper about the discovery of active nanothermite in the World Trade Center. You've read that 25-page paper carefully.
Yeah,
right?
and let me point out
I just want to say that, okay, so you read that paper,
then you know that when they describe the nanothermetic compound that they discovered, that it's a bilayered compound in which one layer is organic, and that this nanothermite is in a carbon matrix. Now, hear me out. The nanothermite is the incendiary. It's true, but the nanocomposite includes carbon and an organic layer, which was the gas-producing layer. The explosive force of any explosion is the expansion of the gas. Now, that gas, that nanothermite compound that Professor Jones found, yes, it creates a great temperature, it's exothermic. But it's the combination of that thermite reaction with the gas-producing organic layer that creates the explosion. So you have to take the exact stuff that Professor Jones found and test that for its explosiveness.
That's what we were doing, Chris. Look, let me just assert, my qualifications for doing this are not inferior to yours, okay? My PhD is in the history and philosophy of science. I organized this research group, just like I did scholars, specifically to look at these issues. We went through all the scientific literature, which you have not done. Nothing in their Bentham article says anything about the quantitative power, the detonation velocity of nanothermite. That's a crucial question. Now,
Hold on. Before we go any farther here, let's recall that the purpose of the call was to hear what's up with Chris Bolin and have a chance to ask him questions. It's not to engage in extensive debate on various issues, but just it's an informational call more than anything.
I want to give
Chris a chance to respond here, and then let's talk about where we're going to go with this call. Okay, go ahead, Chris.
Thanks. The thing is that I have read the literature about this nanothermite. I know Professor Jones, and I've seen him do thermite reactions, but the thermite is not the beginning and the end of this here. The presence of the nanothermite in the dust, I don't think you're saying that's not there. He found this nanothermite, he tested it, he found that it detonated at 430 degrees, and it produced more energy than any known explosive in being used in demolition.
That's completely false. That is totally false. It has 1/13 the explosive force of TNT. Chris, you don't know what you're talking about.
You disagree with him, but let him make his statement, please, Jim, and then we can...
This isn't the Jim Fetzer show.
Mr. Fetzer, this is directly from the paper. This is from the paper that Professor Jones, the peer-reviewed paper. That's exactly what it says. When the specimens were heated to 420 or 430 degrees Celsius, they detonated and they produced more energy than any. And there's graphs in the paper showing the energy released from that chip, those bilayer chips. That's why they're called highly energetic. They release more energy per gram than any explosive known in demolition. I mean, and now what we're saying is that this nanothermite, I mean, this was found in the dust. This is for sure. Now, I can tell you that there was a lot of, you know, there's a lot of people who don't want to talk about the nanothermite in the dust, but argue with the paper. Now, the thing is that this is one element of the 9/11 demolition. There was also thermite. There were obviously cutter charges used because we see many of the core columns that were cut. There'd be 45-degree slices that were cut. That was obviously done with thermite. There were obviously also powerful explosives that went off in the core part of the building that threw these objects, you know, these girders with great velocity out the side of the building. Then there was obviously some very powerful explosives that went off in the basement. You know, I don't know if there's a nuclear bomb or not. Then furthermore, if the people had this much I don't see the evidence of a nuclear bomb being placed on every 10 floors because I don't see the signature of a nuclear explosion. What I see is I see pulverization and I see explosives and I see squibs. It's true that the North Tower and the South Tower demolition do not look like the Building 7 demolition. The Building 7 demolition looks much more like a classic demolition. But in both cases, we see the complete pulverization of those floors. The concrete, the 4-inch concrete floors are pulverized, and the pans are destroyed, and everything that was on those floors is destroyed. And I think that the nanothermite, you know, when you have so much, you talk about U.S. geological study of the dust, one of the characteristics of the dust in the World Trade Center is something like 5% of solidified molten droplets of iron. Well, what produced that, if not thermite?
Listen, Chris, I think you're a great guy, and I'm just asking you to open your mind to the evidence because you're ignoring what else is found in the dust samples, the barium, the strontium, the thorium, the uranium, the lithium, the lanthanum, the yttrium, the chromium. Listen, it's all there. Those are the signatures of nuclear events, all right? They are there. And let me make one final remark, because obviously people don't want me to challenge you on any aspect of this. When you talked about depleted uranium in the Middle East and Fallujah, mm-hmm. I have interviewed several times Christopher Busby. He's a leading expert on the relation between environmental causes and cancer. He went to Fallujah expecting he was going to find that all these birth defects, which are massive, were caused by depleted uranium. What he discovered instead was that they have been caused by enriched uranium from a new class of nuclear weapons. They appear to be neutron bombs, a new class that the United States has been using, and they're of a kind that are similar to what appears to have been used in the World Trade Center. Now, the point is the evidence is there. I invite you to look at it. Go to the Complete Midwest Truth Conference and check out part two where I discuss it, if you would be so kind.
I would just say one thing, Jim. I know you're very passionate about what you argue, and you have your beliefs. I would just say, as a scientist, you are a scientist. You've been trained as a scientist. Then your duty would be to produce a paper, a peer-reviewed paper, to support your beliefs. That's how it works.
Chris, we're putting all these articles out to get review from the members of the 9/11 community like you. So look at the article and give me feedback.
I am not the judge and the jury. The judge and the jury for such scientific claims is the scientific community.
Yeah, okay.
So you have to make your presentation.
Listen,
I'm going to ask that we curtail this here with Jim making a challenge to Chris to look at the evidence for nuclear residues in the dust and his part, Chris challenging Jim to publish a scientific paper on his position regarding the evidence. So let's leave it there for right now. And I'd like to ask if anybody is on the call now that was not on the call earlier that had registered for the call and would like to ask Chris a question. Is there anybody new on the call?
Has Gerhard come back? Gerhard,
yes, we missed you earlier when we did call on you earlier. So you may go ahead and ask any question you have of Chris. Go ahead. Gerhard, go ahead. Gerhard?
Does anybody have a question?
Mike Booth?
Mike Booth. Okay, I'm sorry. We overlooked you. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I just had a question for Chris. After years of study and inactivity in the organization, we haven't been able to get any kind of media, serious media coverage. You see a note or any point of an activity or that you would endorse that would possibly get the attention and basically have to be reported by the mainstream so that we could get this story out? Is there an event or
anything? Okay, 9/11 truth, you mean? Is that what you're saying? How to get 9/11 truth into the media?
Is there any way we could get it, on the front page again, and have the story be factual instead of from the government?
Well, this is the thing. I have to tell you that my experience is that the media is completely controlled in the United States to such a degree that it is controlled by people who are basically co-conspirators in the crime of 9/11, in that the deception of what happened on 9/11, the lies, the government lies. Even Jim Fetzer will agree that the government has lied about what happened on 9/11. We may not have all the answers, but we know that the government story is demonstrably false. They have lied to us, and the media has lied to us. This is because the media is owned today in the United States by a handful of people. Not like it used to be where it was, scores of owners. Now it's a handful of people. I mean, Mr. Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch, designist from Australia. He owns, you know, television and print media in country in towns across the United States. He owns the radio, television, and print media in states, in whole areas. So the people are not hearing both sides of the story. They're not hearing. And 9/11 truth has not been addressed or covered by any mainstream media in the United States in the past 12 years. This is outrageous. This is the reason why we have such a misinformed population, where you have kids going off to Iraq believing that Saddam Hussein did 9/11 and putting their lives on the line in a far away distant country, you know, because of a lie. Now, the media is not going to change. They're not going to, that's like asking a tiger to change his stripes. The media is not going to start changing and being pro 9/11 because Jim Fetzer, for example, does a study where unless he flies an airplane into a building to prove that it will not go into the building or something. It's not going to happen. We're not going to get it. You know, C-SPAN, even C-SPAN. I used to think that C-SPAN was somehow neutral. Well, it's owned by the cable TV network. It's owned by the people who own CNN and cable TV. They're not neutral at all. They sit down and talk to Mr. Chertoff and don't ask him anything about the destruction of evidence of 9/11. How can that be? Isn't the man who oversaw the destruction of the evidence from the mass murder of 3,000 people, and you don't even ask him a question about it? But this is the thing. Our struggle is against the media. The media is not on our side. The media is not on the side of truth. The media is on the side of the owners. The owners are the people who are beneficiaries of this $700 billion being spent on weapons every year. The defense budget of the United States today is over $700 billion a year. We spend more in the United States on defense than all the other 10 countries, the next 10 countries, China, Russia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We spend more in 1 year in our relatively small country than all these other countries in the world. This is the sickness. This is the problem. This is what Eisenhower, you should know about it, right? Wasn't it Eisenhower who warned us of this military-industrial complex in 1959, the same year that the Crown family took over General Dynamics? This is it. And they own the media. This money, this huge amount of money is being spent for the weapons, you know, they're tied into the media at every level. They own the media. They own these little Jewish groups, Hillel. They control this B'nai B'rith. Money talks, and they want the wars because wars sell. They want to continue these wars because by plundering the Middle East, they're making billions of dollars. By selling the weapons, they're making billions of dollars. And the only people that are losing is the dumb public who sends their boys and girls off to these wars and who pays the taxes that goes directly into the banksters' pockets and the pockets of the people who make the weapons. That's it. You know, we are basically up against these people. This is it. That's all I have to say.
Great. Okay, one real quick question.
If you've identified the wall, is there a bigger bigger stone that we can get? Is there any kind of a thing that the media could not report? One flying over the streets? Anything.
Say again? Bigger stone. What do you mean?
Well, you've identified Goliath. I mean, we've got a huge... issues there, and you're right, they're impenetrable, but there's a way, it's going to happen. It's not going to happen, we're not going to take on the U.S. military in a revolution, it's going to happen some way. Have you thought of, or if you have anything that you've kind of thought of that, hey, this might work? I think the discussion kind of needs to go in that direction a little more, is how do we do this? We're still combating over what happened that day as opposed to what's happening 12 years later to get people on board.
Yes. Well, that's what I say is that you know, 9/11 is the manifestation of this. You know, 9/11 was a huge wake up call for the United States. It was a wake up call for the American people. If the American people don't wake up, you know, they led up to it with Waco and Flight 800 and the murders of those people in Idaho, and you know, they increased the ante until we got to 9/11. They wanted to see what they could get away with. Oklahoma City, Waco, what have you, and then they did 9/11, you know, and it's like, that people, that any people in a free country can accept that their government and their media participate in the deception based on a pack of lies about what happened on 9/11. Now, these are not just, you know, Mr. Fetzer and me talking. These are lies that are proven. I think Architects and Engineers has done a great job because they have made it plainly clear, without pointing fingers at any culprit, they have made it clear to every American that there is no way that the government's version of 9/11 is true. I mean, they've done a great thing. You know, my credentials or my presentation, people will say, oh, he's got an agenda, oh, he doesn't like the Israelis, or what have you. But Architects and Engineers have been completely politically neutral, but they have shown that the government version of what happened on 9/11 is completely false. And in that, they've done a very, very good thing. There's no question about it. But how can you, the American people, even with the evidence that Architects and Engineers gives them, you know, more than 50% of the American people do not believe the government version. But has that changed anything? Well, look at what happened in 2008 with the trillion-dollar bailout, the multi-billion-dollar bailout of 2008-2009, which began under Bush and continued under Obama. This was opposed by the American people at a rate of 1,000 to 1. 1,000 to 1. A senator from South Carolina said that the call to come into his office and the ratio of anti to pro was 1,000 to 1. But did that slow it down? Not for a minute. Because the American people have two serious problems that other countries don't have. We have the least free media. We have the most controlled media. That might be hard for people to understand, but we have the most controlled media in the world, and we have this huge military complex that is, as I said, bigger than all the other countries in the world put together. And you have little truth, 9/11 truthers like you and me trying to stand up against this Goliath. We have the biggest Goliath to fight, and we are the weakest of David. That's our problem. In Egypt,
so what do we do?
Well, we do the best we can. We inform ourselves. We form groups, and we try to weed out the infiltrators. We try to form groups that are solid, and we create unity, and we carry on with what we're doing. We have to fight this. But we are, the deck is stacked against us in the United States of America, because as you know, the military industrial complex, they will kill people, they will kill Americans. Look at what they did to Michael Hastings or Philip Marshall. Look what happened to me. You know, it's going to be a very, very difficult thing in the United States. I say we have to be nonviolent because we don't have a chance. If we use any violence, it'll ruin the goal, and it'll give them every excuse to just come down hard on us and to destroy us. So we have to be nonviolent, and we have to be based on truth, and we have to do our best efforts to try to bring the truth to the American people. What else can we do?
Legal informationing.
Thank you.
Right. Right.
Okay. It is now, let's see, 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time, which means that we've been on the call 2.5 hours, and I can't thank Christopher enough for having spent this amount of time with us. I would hesitate to ask him to spend more time, but I don't know what his situation is or how important it is for him to go on and do other things at this point. I know there are probably some people that might want to continue the discussion with him, however. So I'll first ask...
I can hang around for a little bit longer. A little bit longer.
Yeah, a little bit longer? Okay. All right, then, if that's the case, how many people would like to ask anything else or make any other comments, remembering that you're supposed to be limiting yourself to about a minute of speaking time? We mostly want to hear from Christopher today. But we can get a little bit laxer on that if you wish at this point. So how many people, just say aye if you'd like to, if you have anything else you'd like to add to the discussion.
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Aye. All right, so what we'll do then is we'll create our stack as usual, and then we'll just continue the discussion accordingly. So who would like to be on the stack?
Robin.
Great.
Barbara.
Who else?
Robin.
Jim.
Craig,
Robin, Sheila. Okay, I've got Robin, Barbara, Robin, and Sheila. Who else?
Jim Fetzer.
Craig.
Jim Fetzer. Who else? Okay, I've got Barbara, Robin, Sheila, Jim Fetzer. Who else?
Craig McGee asked.
Craig, okay, who else?
I asked.
Lorenzo.
Okay, we're all talking about your Barbara, Robin, Sheila, Jim, and Craig. Who else?
Can you hear me?
Lorenzo? Okay. Yeah, I got you, Craig.
I can hear you, Craig. Craig, you never got to ask your first question, did you?
Yeah, he did.
Well, I did ask a question. Yes, I followed the one-minute rule at the beginning, and so I would like to follow up on it, yeah.
Okay. So I've got Barbara, Robin, Sheila, Jim Fester, Craig, and Lorenzo. Who else would like to be on the second stack for second question?
I'm not really thrilled to be put kind of to be behind a lot of people that actually took a very long time in asking questions the first time around. I will be, but I'm not real happy about it, to be honest.
Well, I'm going to say this. In the second round, and to make sure that everybody has a chance to get their question out, we are going to follow through with the agreed limit to 1 minute per questioner, okay? So that will...
Well, why don't you just let Craig go first, because we've already heard, like, maybe 15 minutes or so from Robin Horton.
Let's do this democratically. Is there any objection to Craig speaking first?
No.
Hearing none, then we will put Craig first on the list. And then I've got Craig, Barbara, Robin, Sheila, Jim Fester, and Lorenzo. Is there anybody else that would like to be added to the stack? Hearing none, Craig, you're first. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I did, you know, there were things I would have followed up the first time if I was going to be lax on the time, so that's why I wanted to get an opportunity now. Chris, to follow up on what I asked you initially about the idea of Hollywood films being used as part of the deception, you gave us sort of the background on Zulkin and his involvement in Hollywood, but I did want to follow up and sort of look for something broader than that, because it seems like if you go over a lot of the Hollywood films that were made in the 90s, and seemed even more as you got towards the late 90s, there are all kinds of ones that have even the number 9/11 seem to be in there, the Twin Towers themselves being destroyed, you have video games, you have all kinds of things, even the movie Fight Club, which Milken was involved in, mentioned Ground Zero and controlled demolition. It was very blatant. And so what I want to know is, do you see that beyond just an individual like Milken, do you see that there was a broad use of images of what was to come in films, and do you see this as a reason of, I guess, possibly preparing us to accept it, or as part of a regular thing to tell us a false reality?
I'm familiar with what you're talking about. I think that it's very clear that people like Arnon Milchan and his Mossad buddies in Hollywood were privy, they knew about the plan to do this, and they were part of the planning, and so they made some films to put this idea and image into American minds of the world around the world. Yes, but even more importantly, Hollywood in the 80s and 90s, as you said, was producing a lot of anti-Arab films. The Muslim and the Arab was always shown as being the terrorist, the bad guy, the evil one, and they were maligned to such a degree that in the American mind, more importantly than just like the planes hitting the buildings, there was this animus, this hostility, this hatred, this mistrust of Islam and the Arab. And this is very important, because you have to create the enemy, you have to create the foe, you have to create the hatred. This is what the propagandists in World War II did. Ilya Ehrenberg from the Russian side and Goebbels from the Nazi side, what have you. And this propaganda has to create the enemy. And so that you create in the mind of young Americans a hatred for people of the Middle East, you know, the Arabs and the Muslims. And the 9/11 deviation was very clear. You know, they showed it in The Lone Gunman. It was shown to millions and millions of American viewers in March of 2001, I think it was, 6 months before 9/11. It was shown on TV. He's made movies about this. You know, all these, like you said, these symbols that are seen, 9/11, what have you. Yes, people used that because maybe they were told that there was to be something, use this, but in any case, the more dangerous thing is to create this hostility and hatred for your intended foe, because that's what they had to do, and they spent decades doing that. And I visited the anti-discrimination campaign in Washington, D.C. early on, and I saw that that group was also being controlled by Jews. And I said, that doesn't make sense. But now it makes sense, because the only group in America that was standing up for the how Arabs were presented in the media was this ADC, and they were completely ineffective. Completely. And that's what we got. So we have all these young Americans hating Arabs, hating Muslims, and when they see the 9/11 crime blamed on the Arabs, they're quick to put on their gear and go off to these countries in the Middle East they know nothing about, and to kill people that they don't understand a word or anything about their culture. I mean, this is so pathetic. It's really, that's it.
It's done since the beginning of the country with the Indians. The same thing was done.
Yes.
All the way
through. Yes, but it's true that you certainly could have a lot of people in Hollywood that would have wanted to demonize Muslims, for instance, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they would have advanced knowledge of 9/11. I'm wondering if we really see a sign of advanced knowledge of that particular event.
Yes. Well, with Arnon Milchan, you absolutely do. And Arnon Milchan being so closely connected to, Netanyahu and Shimon Peres. Shimon Peres is the godfather of Israel. He's the real godfather of this whole thing. And he's the president of the country. And that Arnon Milchan has been involved in Mossad crimes going back to the 70s. I mean, this guy is an old-timer. He's been all along. And he is at the highest level of the Mossad. For him to make movies about airliners flying into high-rise buildings, and for his movie to be shown on American TV 6 months before 9/11, I mean, come on, it speaks volumes. Just if you read what I've written, just Google my name, Bolin, and Arnon Milchan, M-I-L-C-H-A-N. You can see I've written extensively about it. This guy is definitely creating the idea, the image in the American mind of what happened on 9/11. No question about it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Okay, the next one on our stack right now would be, hang on just a second, I lost it. I think it's Barbara.
Yeah, hi Chris. I have a two-part question. It's actually one question. And that is, the first part is, what are your plans for the near and even distant future regarding 9/11 truth? And tell us about why Sweden. Is the Swedish government giving you protection in some way? Tell us why there and what your plans are for the future.
Okay, thank you. That's something I ask myself every day. Why Sweden? And what are my plans? Yeah, well, my wife is a Swedish citizen. My children were born in Sweden. And Sweden has a functioning, bureaucratic type social welfare state where, things work pretty well here. The buses work, the trains work, the government works. I have a little business plan where I get a little support from the state, where I'm supposed to be, I'm doing like what Robin Horton does. I'm trying to reach out and share my information and to be our own media and give speeches. And I have to do this in a way that brings in money. I have to try and sell myself, sell my information, and promote myself in a way that I can make a business out of it. That is very hard to do, and I'm trying to do that desperately, but because you see, unlike Alex Jones and all these other people, my little website and my work has been supported only by generous donations from a few people. I mean, a few people have supported me over time. I mean, in my career, I have not been paid to do this work since 2006, since the police attack at my house. So it has all been done on my own dime and donations from some people. And it doesn't pay the bills. So Sweden is a place where, because my wife is Swedish and my kids were born in Sweden, the schools are pretty good. My kids go to school in English. They're in a baccalaureate program. It's not an easy place to live, you know. There's a lot of things I would rather be, but America, the United States of America, where I grew up, doesn't have anything like this. In my hometown in Illinois, you know, my home state, we don't have buses, we don't have trains, we have a few trains. There is no social system to help you when you fall. And in America, if you fall, or if you're homeless, you're desperate. And I just, you know, there are millions of Americans who are today desperately poor and do not have a place to live and do not have good food to eat. And, you know, that's you know, while we're spending billions and billions of dollars on these unnecessary wars. Well, Sweden has been in a war for a long time. And Europe is in many ways a saner place in that respect. You know, they try to stay out of wars, you know. My plans for the future, I definitely want to come and visit the United States and give some book tours and try to spread the word. Of course, there's a little bit of danger there because you just never know what's going to happen in the United States these days. With journalists being killed and with, you know, the violence that we have in America, it's a little thick. It's a scary thing. But that's why I'm in Sweden. It has nothing to do with the fact that my grandfather came to Sweden a long time ago. It's just that, you know, I've lived in Scandinavia, and Scandinavia has a way of life that you just first can live here.
Thank you.
Okay.
Robin, you're next. Please keep it brief.
Christopher, again, thank you very much for today. And I'm just going to be very brief here, kind of closing the circle on what you started to talk about, which is ending up electing Obama. Chomsky is the most sophisticated gatekeeper for Israel on the planet. Everybody, he has followers, and they beg at his knee and listen to everything he's got to say. And I have to just say, you know, it takes Chomsky and Dershowitz, Chomsky at MIT, Dershowitz at Harvard, and you get Mass Ave in Cambridge running in between the two. And I argue that they are part and parcel of the same diminution or destruction of the peace communities as I had outlined before. And that's all I wanted to say. Thanks again, Christopher.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I can just say the proof is in the pudding that Dershowitz and Chomsky have not, you know, we don't have a peace movement. We don't have any resistance to the wars going on in Iraq and Afghanistan or that are maybe closing down now. But we have no 9/11 truth movement coming from these people. We, you know, obviously they have been part of the containment of the damage, because if Mr. Chomsky or Mr. Dershowitz were truly interested in the truth and peace, they would be firstly involved in 9/11 truth. But because 9/11 truth would, you know, the return address of 9/11 truth points right to the state of Israel, they can't go there.
Yeah, they're personally involved in preventing 9/11 truth, period.
That's right. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Sheila.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to talk a little. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about the controlled media here in the United States. I, having worked my whole life as a writer, both in advertising, marketing, and journalism, I have a kind of an idea myself about how this actually functions, and I just want to hear if you maybe have anything to add to that. My guess is that the way that this control works is, well, as you mentioned, top-down, that if you have the leader of the organization setting a certain agenda, it's inevitable that those beneath him are going to fall in line. And, I take an example of, say, as a writer working in an ad agency, you are technically free to... or even as a journalist, you're free to maybe pursue any story you want to pursue. However, that story won't necessarily make it into the paper. And you know that they're not going to keep you on as a reporter if you're not giving them things that they can use, that they can publish. Or as an advertising writer, they're not going to keep you if they can't give you, if you can't produce work that the client wants to actually put on the TV. So I would say from the point of view of a writer that that's probably how it happens, that people watch what happens with their colleagues. They may say, oh, Joe wrote a piece about this topic, about, you know, say, the power of the of AIPAC or the power of ADL, or and you know, and he was demoted or he's no longer here, or, you know, maybe that'd be a topic I shouldn't write about. People pick up and then they just steer themselves away from those topics. So that's my guess about how the actual control works. And I'm wondering if you have anything to add to that about how the control, the whole mechanism of control.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's definitely top down, and it's the people like, you know, Sumner Rush or Sumner Redstone, who runs CBS or ABC, whatever. These organizations are top down. The guy at the top sets the agenda, and if they say that there's not going to be any of this 9/11 truth stuff in the papers or on the TV, it's not going to get there. And one of the first question BBC asked me when I was in London back in 2005 is they wanted to do an interview with me, and the first question these guys asked me was, why are you the only American journalist who doesn't believe the official version of 9/11? And I said, well, if that's the case, it's because other journalists who questioned the 9/11 narrative have been fired for questioning it. And that had already happened. People out in Seattle and various journalists who had questioned, who had challenged the 9/11 narrative from the U.S. government had been fired. I mean, it's as simple as that. And, you know, you saw it happen. There was a few articles that came out, like that one, the Cameron piece about the Israelis on Fox News. One time only. One time only. I mean, the media is that controlled.
Is he gone now?
I don't know if Cameron's gone, but they ended the discussion. They
yeah.
did a four-time piece, you know, they did a four-time piece, and that was it. There is no discussion of 9/11, and I was attacked by Fox News. They got me on, and they tried to you know, smear me as anti-Semite. CNN, the night before I was supposed to go on trial in January 2007, they did a hit piece on me with this Paula Zahn show, and Paula Zahn was married to a Cohen fellow. She's divorced from him now, but it's like they get these girls from Nebraska or these what they call shiksas. They get these blonde shiksas that are married to Jewish men and beholden to the Zionist agenda to, you know, carry the water for them. That's what she was doing. I wonder what Paula Zahn thinks today about what she did. But, you know, they tried to smear me as an anti-Semite so that, and look at the situation, what happened to me in 2006. Undercover police came to my house. I was a working journalist, attacked me in front of my family, tasered me, broke my arm, and arrested me. I mean, and not a single newspaper in the country interviewed me from my side of the story, not even the local papers, Chicago paper, Daily Herald, papers I delivered as a paper boy when I was a little kid. They didn't even ask me my side of the story. And they would only take the police narrative of what happened. Well, you know, when undercover police tell you what happened in Schaumburg or Hoffman Estates, you know, they lie. And my first lawyer told me that police will go on the stand and they will lie and the jury will believe them. And I said, no, that can't be. That's what happened. That's exactly what happened. That's the situation with our media. It's completely controlled, and it's top-down hierarchy, and what the boss says goes. And if you want to keep your job, you do not challenge the dictates from above. That's it. It's simple.
Okay, thank you. Jim Fetcher.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. I have to go now, but thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for being here, Chris. I wanted to bring up that Elizabeth Woolworth has published a piece in Global Research entitled "Search Engine Manipulation: Google and YouTube Suppress Controversial 9/11 Truth That We All Must Become Aware of." Truth Seeker, a program on Russia Today, did one on 9/11 as a false flag attack. It had over 80,000 viewers immediately. It wound up heading toward a quarter of a million, but suddenly it turned into a flat line. And what Elizabeth is reporting is how the search engines are being manipulated. It's not only happening, I believe, with regard to 9/11 truth, but also with regard to JFK, where, by the way, your early remarks about Lyndon Johnson were well taken. General Dynamics is located in Fort Worth. But Lyndon had been involved in giving the new fighter aircraft contract to General Dynamics over Boeing, even though literally Boeing had a plane that flew circles around the General Dynamics aircraft. It was one of three scandals in which he was embroiled on On 22 November 1963, in fact, there was going to be a Senate vote on the Bobby Baker scandal, widely expected to tarnish him so badly that Jack wouldn't be able to run with him again. He had already informed his executive secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, he wasn't going to run with Lyndon again, but after the assassination, of course, all those scandals simply disappeared.
Right. Right. Excellent. That's exactly right. And that's why the Chicago connection, the general connection to the murder of Kennedy is something that, you know, it's very good comments. Exactly right. You know, Jack Ruby came from that gang in Chicago, and he was connected. They're all connected to this this Jewish mafia in Chicago.
You won't believe this, Chris, but we even found a photograph of Malcolm Mack Wallace, who was Lyndon's personal hitman, who murdered a dozen people for Lyndon, including one of his own sisters, and who appears to have been the shooter in the book depository, firing at John Connally in the mistaken belief that it was Ralph Yarborough, at Skull and Bones with George H.W. Bush.
Mm-hmm. Oh, excellent. Excellent. I'd like to see that.
Okay, and lastly, we got Lorenzo. Lorenzo, go ahead.
Hey. Thank you.
Hello, Lorenzo.
Hey, Christopher. Could please repeat your email address first, and then I have a couple of comments and quick questions.
Sure. My email is Olin, B as in boy, O-L-L-Y-N, dot, books, B-O-O-K-S, at yahoo.com. My website is Olin, B-O-L-L-Y-N, .com. If you want, you can also reach me through feedback. And of course, donations are appreciated and accepted by by PayPal or by letter, through letter. So all that information is there on my website, but my email is bolin.books@yahoo.com.
Great. Thank you, Christopher.
Thank you.
Okay, the first comment that I have is relating to the way an aircraft structure interacts with a building structure, and I completely concur that a real aircraft did strike and do damage to the tower. It's not an immovable object and an irresistible force. They both interact and destruct. The other comment is about the possibility, the great possibility of multiple devices being used, especially in the Twin Towers. There's this huge cavity, appears to be almost as though rock was vaporized in a picture in one of the basements of one of the towers.
Mm-hmm.
And it must have been one heck of a thermo, you know, a very high temperature, if that is what it is, a very high temperature action. And I know there were people commenting on, early in the day, coming up from the basement with skin coming off their, their skin hangs. And a comment about journalism. The morning and the afternoon of 9/11, there was an awful lot of honest, living journalism going on. But after building number 7 went down and all the reports of this last building being imploded, the next morning, none of this stuff existed. And it's just amazing how quickly honest journalism was killed. That's my comment. I guess it was mostly comments.
Okay. It's very good. Very good. I wanted to say about the explosions in the basement. I know William Rodriguez talked about this. I know William Rodriguez, and I've heard all this. And I obviously some very powerful explosions went off. You know, I spoke with the seismologist out in California who said that the signature indicated to resemble that of a nuclear explosion, what the kind of nuclear, a big spike, they said that it may have been, that's what it looked like. And as Mr. Fetcher says, there are radioactive things here and there, there's elements. This is not to say that they may have not put dirty bombs in there, because I went to James Cohen High School. James Cohen was the father of the dirty bomb, the person who invented this idea of putting attaching, radioactive material to a conventional bomb and then spreading this material. Who knows? Who knows what they put down there in the basement of the World Trade Center? Is whether they, I don't know what the explosion was down there. This is what Mr. Fetzer has to develop his paper and present it to the scientific community so they can decide its veracity or not. About journalism on 9/11, this is a very good point. As you saw, there was Jamie McIntyre, I think, from CNN in front of the Pentagon, and he was at the Pentagon before anything collapsed, and then he said, you know, there's no evidence of an airplane here anywhere. Okay? Now, there we talk about no airplane, you know, like Mr. Fetzer said.
Right.
Obviously,
agreed.
No airplane flew into the Pentagon because the Pentagon was standing just as it stood every day for 45 minutes before there was the collapse of that section. And whatever bored through those six walls, those six exterior walls of the Pentagon, you know, those three rings, that was not a Boeing 747 or a Boeing 757 fuselage. That was a missile. And Ms. Honegger, Barbara Honegger's work on the Pentagon is amazingly good. As she points out, that there was the real event happened over there by the helicopter pad, as the journalist said in the beginning also. They said something happened at the helicopter pad. And then there was the man from the BBC, I think his name is Stephen Evans. He's a professional journalist on the BBC television. And he was there at South Tower when the whole thing happened. And he was on the TV in London, you know, and he was telling the viewers that he experienced a whole series of explosions. And we cannot estimate, we cannot tell the human damage and the physical damage caused by that series of explosions that he witnessed at the South Tower before it collapsed. So, I mean, there were explosions going off. There was all kinds of bombs going off. And I'm not saying, and I would not say that nanothermite is the only thing. I'm just saying that nanothermite is that one thing that has been proven in the scientific research and in the documentation. That's the same thing that Mr. Fetzer would do. And anybody else, if you want to prove that some sort of nuclear bombs were used, or if you want to prove that dirty bombs were used, what have you, this has to be proven, you know, to the scientific community. But absolutely. The guys in London, when he started talking about a series of explosions, they turned him down. Then they said, well, what did you see, you know? And then he never returned to that subject again. 90 days later, they did a sit-down with him, and he never talked about those explosions. This is because all the eyewitnesses, the city of New York has over 116 people who witnessed explosions at the World Trade Center before and during the explosions, and nobody talks about it. Of course his buildings were blown up. Any 12-year-old kid who looks at those towers coming down will tell you, those towers were exploded. Thank you.
As long as they haven't bought the party line.
yeah, that's right.
That's the Leechu party line.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate all the questions. I thank you for your teleconference. It's been a wonderful experience.
Christopher, we want to thank you once again for sharing all this time with us, giving us a chance to catch up with your work, and finding out a little bit more about some of the more controversial issues involved.
Yes.
And we hope maybe sometime in the distant future we can maybe try this again when other people might be able to participate. But in the meantime, we'll make this an audio of this recording available to everybody in both WAVE and MP3 format so people can listen to it at their convenience who weren't able to be here today. And Christopher, good luck in your work, and thanks again
thank
for
you.
Sharing with us.
Thank you very much.
9/11 for world peace and talk about the Greater Israel Project. That's the winner.
Thank you.
Be sure and tell us ahead of time if you come to the United States, please.
By all means, I will. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
And good night, Mr. Abashwood, you are.